This week's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by the new RLJ Entertainment release, Housewife. After Holly meets with the notorious cult leader Bruce O'Hara, she's led on a twisted journey of waking dreams that begin to unravel the fabric of her reality. Take a trip down the rabbit hole in this visually stunning film from the director of Baskin. Housewife is now available on DVD, VOD, and digital. Get it on Amazon.com today.
Fangoria is back. Resurrected just in time for this Halloween, the magazine that set the standard is coming back as a deluxe 100-page quarterly edition. Set visits, deep dives, new discoveries, fiction, and exclusive artwork. Specific contents are being kept under wraps for now because Fangoria wants you to experience true analog nostalgia when you open that black poly bag and see what's inside for the very first time. But it's not just a magazine anymore. Fangoria is also bringing you novels under its Fangoria Presents label, and Fango is also getting into the movie biz. Be sure to check out their recent release, Puppet Master, The Littlest Reich. Head to Fangoria.com and subscribe to Fangoria. A subscription of $60 will save you about $20 off the cover price. That's Fangoria.com. Subscribe now.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Pure Cinema Podcast. Hey, Elric.
Hey, man. We've been off for a while.
Yeah. No, it's good to be back.
Yeah. So, we're not going to get into horror, even though it's October, because we're Pure Cinema. So, let's keep it to, like, art house fare.
Wait a minute. What the hell is going on here? This is not Pure Cinema.
Wait a minute. Well, this isn't just a disc. Why is we're all here? What is happening right now, Brian?
Oh, my God.
I've totally lost control. I don't know.
How many podcasts does a human have?
It's like, Brian, it's like your two lovers walked into the same room at the same time.
And Ernie was there. Like,
we walk in the room, and then Ernie's on the couch.
And Ernie's like, guys,
this is going to get weird.
This is out of control already. I don't understand. But what's happening? Do you want to explain what's going on here, Brian? Because we don't get it.
I think this is actually an episode of Shockwaves.
It is Shockwaves. This is Shockwaves 116. Welcome. I'm your host, Rob G.
It's October. You're right.
I'm with Elric Kane.
I'm here.
Both Ryan and Beck are out this week. And so we wanted to come up with something fun and interesting. And I don't think we've had Brian on this iteration of the show. He was on Killer POV.
Yes, I was. It was great.
Yeah, and we've obviously you do a show with him, Elric, mm-hmm. and I've done episodes of Just the Discs. And so we were like, you know, it's time to bring Brian in for Shockwaves.
And I had an idea that, because we usually do a Halloween thing, but we're not on air right now. And so I had an idea for a Halloween thing for that show, but then
we weren't on,
so we're going to kind of play. And so,
do you want to tease the idea before we jump into what we've been up to? We'll get to it. We may be programming a little something for you to watch. All night this Sunday. But I think first
we're going to have to, and I'm sure you're going to have some that you've been watching too, but like what we've been watching, because I feel like October, this is when people need to know this stuff.
It has been madness. I have not been watching a lot, but I've been partaking in Halloween activities,
yeah.
if you'd like to hear about that.
Yeah.
My girlfriend's in town, and so we went and did, she's sitting over there.
I couldn't convince her to come on the microphone. I tried.
We went to Universal Halloween Horror Nights. We went to Not Scary Farm, and we've got Haunted Hayride coming up this Friday, but... yeah, I mean, this is kind of the time. Elric, you and I have gone to Halloween Horror Nights, and it's an absolute blast for me. I mean, it is a little pricey, but that's the thing. It's if you're gonna go all out for Halloween, it's worth putting a little extra money aside to do these kind of interactive mazes, and not the extreme haunts we talked about a few weeks ago. That's not my speed, but this is something that's kind of interesting. And Universal this year, they always get well-known properties and do mazes based on them. And so this year they've got Stranger Things, they've got Poltergeist, they've got Halloween 4, they've got a couple of Blumhouse properties. They have a sort of a remix of the Universal Monsters with music by Slash from Guns N' Roses. So they had a lot of really crazy stuff this year. Oh, a trick-or-treat maze.
How badass was Poltergeist? Because that's the one I had heard.
Poltergeist was actually pretty great. Okay. Yeah, I think if I had this, my favorites this year were Stranger Things was terrific. And what was cool about that one is they basically built an entire soundstage for it. So it's really big. And you know the deal. Basically, you are walking through the first season of the show. So you get to kind of like, you know, live through the plot of the movie or the show in this case. So Stranger Things was really top notch. Trick or Treat was probably my second favorite. And that one's fun because it's an anthology. There's actually like writing of the chapters on each wall as you go into that chapter. You know, so it's like the principal.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you walk in and you see a kid, a puppet of a kid vomiting profusely all over the stairs. And you're like, oh, that's amazing.
Weren't all the titles from movies? The first season? I thought the first season was all like horror movies or something. Maybe I'm mistaken.
Oh, no. You're thinking Stranger Things season two. Oh, no, no, no.
Something
they
was.
Didn't do that. No, that was in Riverdale, I thought.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, Riverdale does.
Riverdale did it, Riverdale and Scream does. Season 2 did okay, every episode as a horror right. movie title. Yeah,
for some
yeah,
reason,
yeah.
I thought Stranger Things. Okay.
Yeah. No, but Stranger Things didn't. They released the titles much in advance.
Yeah. They just rip off each movie.
Yeah, yeah, well, pretty much. Yeah. this is the movie ripping off this time. So that was really cool. Yeah, Poltergeist was terrific. I mean, they do a lot of fun stuff with the static and obviously the tree.
Did you get the face melt?
You do get the face melt for sure. Yeah, yeah, that's a great one. And of course, I gave the finger to the clown as soon as I saw it. I was like,
yeah, no thanks. Never need it again. Yeah.
So yeah, overall, I would strongly recommend it. However, I think I had a better time at Not Scary Farm this year, which is a little further out if you're in Hollywood, but worth the trek. Not nearly as expensive. Again, I always recommend Front of the Line or Express Pass, whatever deal they have for these things, because you'll get to do a lot more if you're able to just kind of cut the line. And that's the whole point of them, is you literally get to cut the line and you don't have to wait too long. But I've said it before, I'll say it again, the reason I love Knott's is because they don't do famous IP, so they are more creative with what they do, because they can do whatever the hell they want. And so they had a couple of new mazes there this year. One of them, I forget the name of it, I should have brought the pamphlet. It was like Dark Something, but you walk into a mine, and I just immediately assumed it was going to be like a My Bloody Valentine sort of deal. And so, you know, you're in the first couple of rooms, and that's kind of the vibe they're going for. But basically, the plot of this thing is that they've uncovered some sort of like underwater like world with like fish monsters and like shark people and stuff. So then all of a sudden, you're kind of like in this underwater world, and they did this great effect where there's like this green light in the room. That looks
so like you're in water.
It looks like you were in water, even though you weren't. And like these little fish people would like jump out from under it, and so like, oh, so
I think
so
we have the wrong
like,
host to appreciate this. This is a pure Becca experience.
If Becca's listening, go to Not Scary Farm so you can appreciate the fish people. It's right up your alley. Speaking of, then there was another one that was a spaceship, and you walk in. I mean, it looks like a spaceship, but gone awry, and you're like, oh, did they crash? What happened? And it was like Event Horizon meets The Thing. They were like, these people were like melting and like losing their minds, but then like parasites were coming out of their chests and stuff like that. And so like, again, that blew me away, because you walk into something at Knott's and you have no idea what to expect. And then you see something cool like that, and you're like, oh, that's kind of amazing. And they also tend to have incredible elaborate animatronics. It's actors' animatronics and stuff. So that was basically what I did this week. I saw some movies too, but I want to hear about you're wearing a shirt that says Cronenberg for president.
Yeah, I had to fight for that. Some people had to be shot in the face with the they had the t-shirt gun, and instead of just giving them away, people would come up and have to literally be shot in the body to get one. And
oh,
I was like,
wow.
That's very, very Cronenberg in a sense. Beyond Fest opened in LA, and it's, you know, unfortunately this year I am going to be away for most of it, so I needed to channel the start, and I got lucky enough to get my hands on some of the Cronenberg. But first, I saw Climax, which is one you had asked me about. Gaspar Noé's new film, which I really like. I don't think I loved it compared to some of what I was lacking in it. It surprised me first that was the one that won a prize at Cannes for him.
Yeah.
Because even though it's kind of an amazing nightmare to watch, it has no real narrative or characters to care about, whereas like Irreversible can destroy you because it's got an emotional through line.
Sure.
So I really enjoyed watching this, the experience of watching this, but I also, it was hard to connect because it's disconnected, and it's like watching madness for an hour and a half. But what I loved, and any longtime listener will appreciate this, is I was sitting next to Brian Collins, Becca and Brian Collins. Becca was very lukewarm on it, who I thought would like it because it had dance. Brian Collins, who I was sure would hate this movie, because this to me is just like a non-narrative, Brian Collins tweeted that night that it was the best film of the year. I went outside. Mike Williamson said, not only is it the worst film of the year, but it's one of the worst films he's ever seen in his entire life.
Wow.
So now we have the two perfect polls. And if you follow the show, you'll know why those two guys are the perfect barometers of life.
New drunken debates.
Exactly. So I would say I fall strictly in the middle, but I think it's totally fascinating. As a Noé film, it's really interesting to watch. It has amazing, you know, camera work. And it's just like, I don't care that bad things are happening to people because they're all a bunch of assholes. The opening 20 minutes, I think, is maybe one of my favorite openings of the year in terms of just energy. Like, it's pretty amazing, the dance kind of stuff. So really interesting movie. But, you know, again, it's definitely not going to be for everyone. But then, you know, then we had, I spent, these are the things I watched of Cronenberg's. One day I saw in order Shivers, Rabid, The Brood, and Scanners. So got there at 9 a.m.
Oh, my God.
There's a list. There was a line of Cronenberg, you know, fanatics out there at Saturday at 9 a.m., which was amazing to see. All in 35. The Brood was one of the best-looking prints I've ever seen. Same with Scanners. Those two prints were flawless. Mm. The first couple, you know, there's some scratches, but it's still great. So we watched those four. So I was there, and then it gets to be like 7 at night. And then Dead Ringers was that night, a separate ticket with Cronenberg. So that was Cronenberg, like, popping up for the first time. We're all, like, with Howard Shore. And this is a guy who hasn't been down here doing something like this.
So did you do all five movies?
I did this. This is one of my days. Oh, so my Saturday was that. And I'll talk about the experience. And then the couple days, I couldn't get tickets to The Fly, but I had seen it pretty recently. So two nights ago, I went to Videodrome, which I hadn't seen in a long time, and Existence, which I'd only seen when it came out in theaters. I wasn't the biggest fan of theaters. So those two again, and he talked between them with a great fucking key. Like, probably the standout Q&A in some ways was Lee Winnell's work.
Oh.
Because it's perfect, because Upgrade fits so perfectly between those two movies. And it was really cool, because he's kind of, you know, he's not a trained question asker, but he was really into it, and so it was a nice Q&A. But there was a couple interesting finds, besides the fact that cool things to learn about Cronenberg that I did not know. Mm-hmm. What, out of all the masters of horror, he might be the funniest. Seriously, did not expect that. Every single line is a joke. He doesn't take anything seriously.
Yeah.
Mick Garris is into, wait till you hear the Mick Garris. Everything Mick would say is hit with Cronenberg with a joke and a pun and a line. And everyone's sitting there going, oh my God, he is just like, he just doesn't take it seriously. And he's like, you know, constantly making fun of the audience and movies. And so that was really cool. And the other thing is, watching his movies in a theater, you realize there's a lot of humor in them. But when you watch them at home, you don't really see it.
Yeah.
See, Videodrome was getting laughs in the right place, laughing. Like, there's actual jokes and satire. Yeah, obviously there's satire in all his work. But so that was really cool to see. But then the weird thing I had, and I'm not saying this to be like purposely political, or to be like, I'm one of the good guys, you know, like Twitter is just so full of, you know, guys trying to come to the aid of thinking that damsels are in distress, which they are not. I will say, in all my life of watching movies, I've never had an experience like this with Shivers. That next morning, it was like 2 days after the Kavanaugh Ford hearings.
Yeah.
And I sat down to watch this movie, and the opening scene of that film is an older man basically trying to attack this girl in a school uniform. And I'm sitting in the theater, and it's the first time I've kind of started to feel and notice violence against a female character in a horror film, whereas we watch so much of it because it's part of the genre, I don't really notice it. It's just happening. And so I started feeling the political nature of his work for the first time in my life. I totally felt how, like, really with a filmmaker who's thinking about it, which Cronenberg always was, it's all about sexual politics, it's like looking into a reflection that's still completely relevant and current. Sadly, it's very current right now. But then Rabid plays, and I posted on it, but without spoilers, the last image of Rabid is Rose, the central protagonist, on being dumped into a dump truck and taken away. And I just literally thought of the doctor who just testified against him, thinking, like, as soon as she testifies, her life's over, and then she's dumped on a truck and forgotten, and the car keeps driving.
Crazy.
And so you just – I started seeing that, and it was kind of exciting, to be perfectly honest, to see his film, this genre work, like horror films, for sure horror films and sci-fi films. But seeing it through a slightly different lens, because I was affected emotionally by those hearings. And so, again, it doesn't mean it's about those things. It's not. But if you can be that relevant a filmmaker, your themes in your work. And the other thing I think that people might find interesting is when asked about body horror, he and technology, you know, the merging, which, you know, he made a joke. He goes, well, I've got a hearing aid that connects to a satellite in my ear being controlled by Russians. You know, and he's got a gun. No, he didn't say that. but he was saying, like, to me, there was never a difference. I don't think I was, like, predicting things. I just, all technology is an extension of the human body anyway. Everything, even a can is designed to fit in my hand. So he was like, so to me, it was always natural the two things would combine. So that's where all his films, when you start watching them in order, the one thing I saw, because I've never watched his films in order, especially those first four, is you realize most great artists make a couple of the films that we think of them, and then they make something big, and then like Lynch made a little Lynch movie, then got Elephant Man, which wouldn't be considered like a Lynch movie, then made this giant fucking thing called Dune, And then only after that could he come back and become David Lynch.
Yeah.
Cronenberg, every single film was one micro step to the next project.
Yeah, and they totally.
Absolute symmetry. It's unbelievable. Like watching those four in a row, it's the same movie with little movements and getting a little bit bigger. And then you get to Dead Zone where he makes this big leap. And then he gets to The Fly and he makes a master. And you're like, oh, like this was like a total trajectory of an artist, which I can't think of anyone else in that who kind of had that career. So, you know, super impressive, but it was a lot of fun hearing him talk. It'll definitely be like one of my kind of life highlights, just seeing them all in such quick succession.
I kind of want to marathon them now.
No, I mean, and the one that stands out, even though they're all great, like I didn't dislike anything. I mean, Existenz at times still floats a little too much narratively. It almost feels like it's scriptless at times, like it's just part of the dreaminess of it. Mm. But I think the one that stands out is The Brood. Like, it's the only one that doesn't have humor. And he has humor in all his movies, but The Brood is fucking straight because it's coming like Possession from that painful divorce he was going through.
Yeah, yeah.
And he talked about how he had a dream. That's where it came from. He actually dreamed during the divorce. He's separated from his wife, and he woke up having this nightmare where she had like birthed new kids to come back and take get him or something, and that's where you kind of. But it's really humorless, like it's this, but it's beautifully made, and it's kind of like The Fly in terms of like it's really entertaining, but it's also a deep movie. So, but anyway, so yeah, it was super interesting. So I'm very glad, and I have a T-shirt to show for it.
Yeah, that's pretty intense.
But it was interesting. Yeah, I think that's interesting. Like, because we always talk about politics. I never think about him when I was thinking about political horror, where we've talked about before.
Yeah.
We talked about Get Out.
I don't know if any
of
his stuff has come out.
No,
in that context.
But watching it in
other
this
than
way,
the Dead Zone. Yeah, yeah, pretty obviously.
Yeah, the Dead Zone. But now I realize I think that's always been a concern of his is sexual politics. Like, what happens to people who are vulnerable being dominated? By, and it's not always men dominating women, but that's obviously a big part of it. Man, yeah, great filmmaker though, and so cool. Let me put it this way: anyone, because he's older, he did not seem it, and I kept thinking, man, I'd give that guy a podcast; he would be hilarious. I'm excited for people to hear Mick's show. I think this will probably come out before that, but look out for it because he did a really great Q&A, and it'll be really funny.
Cool. Yeah. No, I can't wait to hear it.
So that's the wrap.
What about you, Brian? What have you been watching lately? Are you getting ready? Are you an all horror guy when it comes to Halloween season? I mean, I know you have kids and stuff, so I'm curious how you prepare for October.
Plus, you probably can't because you have to do all those disc reviews.
I do have a lot of other stuff that I'm watching. It depends on the year, Rob. Some years I'm feeling more inspired than others. This year I'm not necessarily feeling horror inspired.
Okay.
Also, you know, there's stuff we're working on for Pure Cinema that's getting in my way. And so the only stuff I've seen recently, I've seen in the theater, a couple that could tie in to sort of a horror thing. One is called Assassination Nation.
I'm really interested
about this one.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to summarize it, I think I took a note and it was like, what did I say? I said, I mean, I haven't even seen Black Mirror, but I know enough about it to be like, okay, it feels like Black Mirror meets a little bit of The Purge, meets maybe a little bit of Pump Up the Volume.
Yeah,
but
the spirit of it.
Yeah.
Heathers or
Heathers,
something?
Heathers
I saw
is
that
in
thrown
there.
Around.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so it's about a group of girls that are obviously very device-heavy girls, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of electronic communication. And then basically they're in the town of, I believe, Salem, and a couple key people get their phones hacked and their information spread all over the internet. And the interactions that they're having with other people. Again, I don't want to spoil anything here, but it just sets off this sort of powder keg in town and people start kind of coming at each other and it gets really intense by the end, basically. But I thought it was really interesting, you know, and I thought really good film for right now in a lot of ways. So I don't know. I feel like it's not, it opened wide and then seems like it just totally dropped out of theaters. I don't think it did particularly well, but I would totally recommend people check it out if they're into that sort of a mix, a Twilight Zone kind of.
It looked energetic and crazy. It looked kind of like what I would want Purge to be.
Yeah.
Like a little more interesting in terms of like what's going on.
Yeah, I feel like it could be an interesting Purge-y kind of spinoff. But I liked it quite a bit. I definitely, if it comes to VOD soon, I would say, you know, look for it. And then the other one I took my daughter to was The House with a Clock in Its Walls. Uh-huh. I don't know if you guys have already talked about that on the show.
No, we haven't had any chance to see
it. Yeah, no.
Did you get to see it in 3D with Thriller and all that stuff?
I wish we had. My daughter's not a huge 3D person, but when I heard about the Thriller after the fact, I was like pretty bummed that we didn't at least try. But
Eli Roth.
I know. I got to say, I mean, as much as I enjoyed Cabin Fever and Hostel when they came out, I haven't revisited them too much, so I can't say that they're like intense favorites of mine. So like for me right now, this is probably the best thing he's done in terms of longevity, in terms of something I know that I'll come back to, because it's just a well-made...
Dude, Keanu and two girls.
Come on.
On Father's Day.
Yes.
Two.
Pizza Baby.
I've actually forgotten the name of the movie just now.
Knock Knock.
Yeah.
No, but I like this. And my daughter was seeing it for the second time. She'd seen it as part of a preview thing with my wife. And she actually noticed, again, I won't give anything away, but there's kind of a death or a couple deaths at the end that she seemed to describe as having been much more graphic in the version she saw. And I can kind of see why they changed it, but...
So she saw an advanced screening and they toned it back for this theatrical.
Yeah, I don't think the effects were totally done in the version she saw, but she did remember this death at the end that she's like, that's not what happened in the version. So that was interesting.
They did the cannibal holocaust on the spit. Exactly. It's a little kid.
Yes, she remembered that.
But what's the story with this movie? Because this is based on an old... Is it a Disney thing? Or
I thought it was a series of books, but I could be wrong.
This is when Becca would have been used, because I think it's her favorite kids thing or something.
Yeah. Oh, she really liked it. All the stories, the books.
Yeah, I don't know.
Unfortunately, I don't know the books. I know there's a series, but yeah, it's just basically like a kid goes to his mom and dad pass away. He goes to live with his weird uncle, played by Jack Black, who's actually a warlock, and it teaches him some magic stuff. And there's kind of a ticking clock problem that they have to deal with. And you know, it's a really good Halloween goosebumpsy kind. Like, I thought it was like another Goosebumps movie, but it's a little different. It's not quite as dark. It's a little more family friendly, but I don't know. I thought it was a good time. If you've got a younger kid, I think it could be an interesting gateway movie.
So no one saw Hellfest.
No,
I'm so bummed. I really want to see that. Like, when I saw that, because I didn't hear about it till late, and then I just saw the trailer. I was like, oh, I'd see that. It looks like a straight slasher.
Yeah, I mean, it's so weird because I really was pushing for. I was hoping to acquire a film called Bloodfest.
But
Rooster Teeth produced it, and they're putting it out themselves. Uh-huh. I think it's already out now, actually, on Blu-ray and everything on VOD. And I love that movie, but that's more of a horror comedy.
Yeah.
Like, it's just straightforward horror comedy. But they're similar premises, where basically it's like something happening at one of these type of festival events.
Right. But this one looks big,
Hellfest looks
right?
like the serious version of it, like the straight version of it.
It looks a lot. I mean, it has the cast, a couple casts, but it did look like Scream, the TV show, making a big movie.
Yeah. And one of the girls from it is...
That's probably what made me think that. But I do want to see it. That one, I want to see it in theaters before it disappears, because maybe it won't last long. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that one looked interesting to me.
Yeah. Let's see. I'll throw another title at you guys. So it was Saturday morning. I wanted to dig out a Blu-ray that was romantic to have while I was watching breakfast. And Scream Factory came to the rescue because they put out a little movie called Scream for Help on Blu-ray.
Oh, man. That has one of the best love scenes.
Hold on.
Whoa.
Elric, I remember you talking very, very passionately about this after the triple bill with
Right?
Here's what I have to say about it. So this was directed by Winner Winner Michael Winner.
Yep. He has another one on his hands.
Of Death Wish.
Here we go.
Of Death Wish fame, and written by Tom Holland. And Tom Holland had said, I mean, this is public knowledge, this is the film that made him become a director because he didn't want anyone touching his scripts anymore. This is the one. So we watch this. This is something special.
I mean, it's just
on different level. There's not a single correct creative choice in this entire movie. Like, I've never seen a movie where literally every decision creatively is wrong. It's the wrong cast. It's the wrong music. It's the wrong lenses. Everything is executed exactly the opposite of the way
it
should.
And yet somehow it ends up perfect.
And yet it is so entertaining.
Yeah.
So incredibly entertaining and unbelievable. In fact, there was one thing I was laughing about where there's a sequence kind of early on. Because basically and what's good about the Blu-ray, by the way, is Tom is interviewed on it. And he's very, very candid.
How funny.
And he says, he's like, not for nothing. His first choice was Richard Franklin, who did Psycho 2.
Oh, wow.
And Richard went to go do a different movie. He was already committed to do, like, Link or whatever.
I was going
to
say.
Because they had done Psycho 2, Cloak and Dagger, and then he's like, you know what? If Richard did this, he would have killed it, and we would have had the stepfather before the stepfather. Because this was before that. But Richard couldn't do it, and it went to Michael Winner. It was a studio decision.
What's funny about that is Michael Winner doesn't make – many goofy movies. Like, he makes lots of crazy movies, but like the tone of this is like a lot of his films are too serious. Like Death Wish 2 is too intense and serious. So it's like, God, so it's like, why is he like, why did he find this weird tone in this that's half jokey,
well,
half
it's fun because Tom said that they had like lunch together and he's like, hey, I didn't change a word of your script. And he's like, yeah, that's the problem. He literally did exactly like, because there's one sequence, this is what I was getting at, because the stepfather character in it, because it is basically the stepfather. Yeah. His name is Paul Fox. And so I hashtagged Paul Fox with everything this week because he's amazing. Paul Fox. But basically, everyone repeats full names, like in a whole scene. It's like, why would you think that your stepfather, Paul Fox, is doing anything wrong? He's like, listen, you don't understand about Paul Fox, what I'm talking about. And it's like, Paul Fox is such a nice, good-looking guy.
Oh my gosh.
And so like, you're in one scene where every other line, they're just repeating somebody's full name, like as we do in real life, I guess.
But can we talk about that virginity scene?
Oh, dear God.
That's got to be one of the best scenes ever.
Well, it was funny because somebody, I think it was Shad Youngblood, who's one of our shockers, had commented, most awkward sex scene ever.
Yeah.
And I was like, plural? All of them?
Yeah, pretty much.
Basically, any sex scene in this movie is really inappropriate and awkward. I've never seen a movie that like just bordered so inappropriate.
Yeah. But what I love about it is also how it feels like a TV movie. So it's like you kind of wish that somebody was just playing that on, you know,
regular
back in the
TV?
On TV, pretending it's just like a Lifetime movie out of control.
God. But the dialogue, the situations, it just gets insane.
Yeah.
Scream for Help, listen. It's a must. That's all I have to say.
And watch it with as many people as you can.
If you can, it's much more. Yeah, because you're going to turn to the person next and be like, do you believe what we're watching?
I feel like every year we've had that, we had it. We had Kathy's Curse 1 year. Yep. Then the next year we had our Devil's Honey.
Yes.
And now we have Scream for Help.
Scream for Help every year needs to be seen and believed.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about it.
And you too will want a winner, Michael Winterson. Once that ends, you will purchase one.
I need one.
Yeah.
I did watch one other I'll just quickly mention. I didn't know if either of you had seen Hold the Dark, the new Jeremy Saulnier film.
No.
Not yet.
So I won't go too deep on it. You know, this is one of the bummers of Netflix. One of the cool things is something comes out quickly. One of the bummers is it's, I don't know, there's almost like a anti-climax to a movie that just suddenly it's there on Netflix. I don't know. There's part of me that was excited for that. I think this is a good film. For me, it doesn't kind of quite hit the heights that Blue Ruin and Green Room do, even though it achieves it on a technical level, for sure. Like, there's no doubt.
And there's, like big stars in it, right?
Yeah, there's stars.
A much bigger
Skarsgård,
movie?
Alex Skarsgård. Yeah, but it's a similar world. I just didn't really... It's a very expansive story that keeps switching. I won't use any spoilers. I'll keep this super brief. It shifts characters a lot, so I just didn't really know what to care for, ultimately. The violence is very violent, and in a way that's been consistent in all his work, right? Even Murder Party. And so that, you know, stylistically as a director, I think he does show a lot of growth with this film. And I think he could tackle really huge properties with it now. It was more just like, there's something holding it back for me personally where I just wasn't like in love with it. But it was a really solid movie. Definitely would encourage people to check it out for themselves. But from, you know, it was hard to know, I guess, what to root for because everything just seems so kind of grim.
Yeah.
And this one's written by Macon Blair, who's got a small role in there. But it's, you know, it's an interesting film. But I mean, I'm always happy when, even if you don't love a movie, I'm always happy when it's still consistent with the filmography. It still feels totally part of that filmmaker's work. I think I'm just starting to get to a place where I really like focusing on a character throughout the whole of a film. You know, it's weird. I didn't used to care about that as much. But yeah, check it out. But I don't know. There's something about it that maybe I would have responded more in a theater. You know, there's something about it just popping up on Netflix and being able to just watch it and go, okay, cool, you know, and move on to the next. Yeah, I don't know. It feels a little disposable. But
I want to check that one out. Yeah. I didn't even realize that it was already on Netflix, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, Hold the Dark.
Brian, you have another title as of late?
Nothing else that doesn't relate to the topic, really.
All right, well, we're going to jump into the topic after I mention one more. So how do I follow up the romance that is spawned from Scream for Help? Simple. The next day, while we watched the equally romantic The Toxic Avenger, which Alyssa had never seen before.
Classic.
It's a French classic.
That's Godard? I'm sure. Or Truffaut. I can never remember which one.
Yes. 1984, Lloyd Kaufman and the Michael Hertz and Lloyd Kaufman. I actually haven't seen this in a really, really long
time.
Dude,
I probably haven't seen this since I was like 13 or something.
And it's on Amazon Prime. Yeah. That's the way we watch it because I think the Blu-ray is kind of pricey. Although it's not much of a giant leap to get the entire collection. But here's the thing. The second, third, fourth, they're pretty terrible. But the first one has a certain sense of magic to it. It's my first trauma movie that I saw. And really, I mean, there's a few of the early ones that I love, but I never was a full-fledged Troma guy.
Sergeant Kabuki?
That good. Yeah. You know, not a lot of them are good, but there's a certain sense of magic to Toxic Avenger.
It has a little more heart than most of them. Some of them are kind of mean.
They're pretty mean.
I think that's my biggest
problem.
They're
all mean, yes, including Toxic Avenger is still pretty mean.
Yep.
But hey, it's everything James Gunn learned about filmmaking was from the Toxic Avenger. He wrote the book and everything, so that should explain his tweets. But anyway, this movie, if you haven't seen it, is Troma's masterpiece about a nerdy little guy named Melvin who is tortured by the people at the gym club that he works at. But the gym club kids also happen to be homicidal maniacs that run people over in their car for points. And one day they trick him into wearing a tutu to embarrass him in front of everybody. He falls out the window, falls into toxic waste, and then becomes a superhero. The first superhero from New Jersey, from Tromaville, New Jersey.
Nice.
And literally he goes out, and it reminded me a little of like RoboCop when he first goes out, because when he attacks people, he literally tears them apart. And there is nothing funnier than that. So I had a blast with this. It's still not a good... You know what's funny is like once he gets his revenge, like... It kind of slows down for the last 10, 15 minutes. Like once he takes care of everybody that kind of was mean to him, there's a little bit more with like the mayor, you know, who's obviously responsible for all this toxic waste in the town. And he's corrupt and all this kind of stuff. But it is still a marvel of a movie. And I mean, when I watch this one, it's kind of like, you know, those like super violent things from the 80s, like RoboCop that spawned cartoons and toys. And you're like, I can't believe it. When you watch this movie with the amount of like sex and violence and death and like all that, and like literally he's ripping like limbs off, and you think of like the Marvel comic books for the Toxic Avenger, the Toxic Crusader cartoon. I think he even had cereal, for Christ's sake.
Well, and Schwarzenegger was tapped supposed to play him at one point. So for a
I don't know if he's going to play him. I thought maybe he was going to be the mayor. I don't think this movie could possibly be remade. Like, it is such a relic of its time, and it's very politically correct for...
he could be president. Wasn't that a campaign for a while?
Toxie for president, of course. Yeah. He'd do a much better job.
He would do a much better job.
But yeah, Toxic Avenger is fantastic, and if you're looking to revisit it, it's on Amazon Prime. So
nice.
Definitely worth another romantic...
another romantic look.
Yeah. So, Elric, do you want to explain kind of where this concept came from?
Yes, let's do it. So, we're talking about, last year on Pure Cinema, and we do it here, for Shockwaves, we did 31 films, you know, and we highlighted 31 movies for every day. Last year, we did triple features, which I really enjoyed on Pure Cinema. We did horror triple features, the thematic one. And then the thing that one of the people I'm inspired by for these things is mutual friend of everyone, Phil Blankenship. Yeah. I think he always does a really good job with all-nighters. And all-nighters, to me, have a bit of an art form to them, and because the goal, I have to assume, by the programmer is to keep you awake. I hope that's their goal. I've had some mixed results on that, obviously. So I thought it'd be cool if we programmed an all-nighter, the slots being, you know, 7 p.m. every 2 hours. Obviously, some movies will be a little less, but you get those little walk-around breaks. Starting at 7 p.m. And coming out of the theater probably at 9. I think the last movie we slotted was a 7 a.m. movie.
Yeah, the way you have it here is film 1 is 7 p.m., 9 p.m. is film 2, 11 p.m. is film 3, 1 a.m. is film 4, 3 a.m., and you wrote a note here, film 5, the most dreaded spot for a film to start, so make sure they could stay awake.
Yeah.
5 a.m., that's when you're delirious, is film 6. Yeah. And then 7 a.m., film 7, but you said you should imagine that this is where you get served coffee and donuts for surviving the whole night.
Yeah. So that's based on a couple that I – like my other favorite person and the one who probably – one of my films I'll mention had a direct influence from this one I went to, Ant Timpson, who producer of ABCs of Death and things like that. He programmed some mean all-nighters, and some were actually 24-hour film fest, and one I was at, and I just remember – I'll talk about how delirious in the middle of that. But you gotta look after the people. I think I went to a Buttonumathon, like one of the first ones.
Oh.
Like I think it was Buttonumathon 2, and I just happened to win a ticket to it. I didn't even know much about that culture, and there was a thing – it's actually where I met Ant Timpson, even though he's from New Zealand. Zealand, there was an electrical, like, it looked like a tennis racket, and it would give you a little shock, and people were passing around if anyone fell asleep. You'd get shocked. So I remember seeing RoboCop was playing at like 3 a.m., and I remember seeing people getting shocked in front of me, but it's where I saw Butcher Baker, Nightmare Maker on screen for the first time.
That
and it blew
amazing.
My mind. Like, I was like, holy shit, what is this movie? And this was, like, I was probably 20, you know.
And you know what? The one that I loved, the gimmick I loved, so back in Long Island, we had a theater. It was a little further out in Huntington, the Cinema Arts Center, and they would do, you know, strange double features at midnight, but they had an all-nighter, and their concept was basically it was free, pay to get out. So if you can last the whole night, you don't have to pay for it, but if you go in and whatever point you leave, that is when you pay for your ticket.
It should go, like, the cost should go in how long you stay. Like,
sure,
like, it's a $50 ticket if you leave after movie one.
Yeah,
but then
yeah,
it's
yeah.
like
yeah.
40 30 goes, you know,
that's a good idea too.
That would be,
but
cool.
I always love that concept.
I love
if
that.
You last
great.
The whole thing yeah. it's free, but if you have to pay to go get out.
Yeah, pay to get out, that's a good festival. So, well, and this year we have the New Bev still under, you know, construction, so we don't have our New Bev one, which bums me out, because I've been to that one the last couple of years. So I'm not going to one.
And
this
you did
year.
The Argento one, didn't you?
Did the Argento one, and then there was a really good one that Phil did a couple years before, which is where I saw Kathy's Curse, and then Bad Taste.
Oh my god!
And then something, and like Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
I mean, I was like, oh, this is a good night at the movies. Like, it was great. And then Eric, Phantom of the Mall. So I left at 5:30 a.m.
That's the one that killed.
That
you.
Was the one where I had to leave.
All right, so Brian, why don't you kick it off? We're gonna go slot by slot in the film that you picked.
And then I think at the end, go through all at once, so you get the all-nighter effect at the end when we get to the...
Okay. Okay, so for my 7 o'clock spot, I was going to start old classic horror.
Okay.
Thought that might be a good way to go. I'm going to go with Night of the Demon from 1957.
Great one.
Yeah, a lot of fun. I think this movie...
Also Curse of the Demon.
Yeah, a.k.a. Curse of the Demon. I think this movie... like Val Lewton's films, sort of belongs in the same conversation with the Universal horror movies. I feel like it's of that ilk, and unfortunately this one doesn't get as much attention, but the basic...
Would Val like being called like Universal? You've been listening to the podcast where Val is all anti-Universal.
Yeah, no, obviously he wouldn't appreciate it, but just yeah, in terms of like what older films people connect to nowadays, I love that there's, you know, a lot of fandom for classic horror, yeah. But I feel like, you know, people aren't venturing off into the Val Lewton territory. And this is Jacques Tourneur directed this, so it's got a direct lineage with that. But basically the premise is that Dana Andrews plays like a skeptical professor type who comes to see another professor, I think. And the guy has mysteriously died at the beginning of the film. And Dana Andrews runs into, I guess, his niece, played by Peggy Cummins, who I love from Gun Crazy. And she starts to figure out that there was some curse put on her uncle, and that there's this guy named Carswell who is sort of running a demon, devil cult, and that's what her uncle was investigating, and that, you know, he has used this technique to basically put parchment on somebody to get them to take it, and then they're cursed, and then a demon comes for them, basically. So the whole movie is just... him trying to Dean Andrews just kind of waving off every sign that something bad is coming until the end. And it's pretty cool. There's some actual demons in the movie, and I think they are still kind of effective in the way that they're done.
And they were probably reshoots back then, right? Wasn't it kind of controversial at the time?
Been.
I think so.
Must have been. But I think it's a pretty haunting image that they end up using, and I don't know. For an old movie, I think it's pretty solid and a good way to start off a horror night. For me.
I mean, I think if Val Lewton had produced that as well, it'd be my favorite of the whole. Of all of that period.
Yeah.
But there's something that I feel like I'm betraying Val. I mean, Tourneur is incredibly talented, and I'm sure he's heavily influenced by their collaboration. But I agree. I think Curse, and this has got a big release coming out soon.
Yeah, it does.
Indicators.
A really good one.
Oh, great.
Region free, double disc, multiple cuts of the movie, tons. It's going to be one of my releases of the year, I can tell.
It's really terrific. It was totally like when I was going for my, because I have an old slot as well, and that was definitely in my mind. I was like, I'll see. But
I thought maybe.
Yeah. It's a great fucking movie.
All right. So that's 7 p.m., 9 p.m.
Oh, wait, are we going through each person's all?
Well, I think it'd be weird if we go one at a time. Like, it's like, let me hear your whole night.
Okay.
All right.
And then your whole night
and
my whole night.
All right.
Yeah, it's just, to me, it feels more logical.
Yeah, you're probably
right. Okay, so for my 9 p.m. slot, I'm going to try and continue sort of an occultish thematic, not necessarily through the whole night, but into this second movie. This is one I actually have called out on Pure Cinema, I think on our Scream Factory episode. And I think I'm just going to keep banging the drum for this movie because I don't think it gets enough love, and that's I, Madman.
Yes.
From 1989, I think.
Yeah.
Tibor directed, the guy who directed The Gate. And basically, it's sort of the story of Jenny Wright, who's one of my favorite 80s actresses.
Near Dark.
Oh, she's so good.
Terrific.
Just love her. And so she plays this girl who works at a used bookstore, and she's really into horror novels. And she finds this one called I'm Madman. She starts to read it, and it becomes one of those things where, you know, characters in the book start to enter into her real life. But it's also kind of done like a film noir. So there's parts where she's like sort of imagining what's going on in the book and herself in like a femme fatale sort of visage or look. And then she'll come out of it. It's like a dream. You know, all the while this stuff is happening, she has a boyfriend played by Clayton Rohner, who's another one of my favorite 80s actors. He was in April Fool's Day, Modern Girls, just one of the guys.
Yes.
And he's a cop, and she's trying to convince him that this is really happening. And it's got some really cool sequences with the killer, and there's some cool sort of stop-motion sequences that rival the stuff in The Gate. And I think those elements rolled together really make for a fun package ultimately.
Yeah, Randall Cook, who did the effects for The Gate, also did those for I, Madman. That's why they kind of have a similar feel to them.
Yeah, it's like not quite a Harryhausen, but it's definitely descended from those things. So I think that's a good – and, you know, so you've got a classic with, you know, Curse of the Demon, Night of the Demon, and then – carrying into the 80s, kind of keep it a little more modern to kind of keep people interested was my MO.
Yeah.
And then the next slot is what, 11?
11 p.m. All right, we're getting late in the night.
And I view that as like the prime spot. Because people can go to an all-nighter. I mean, I'm not saying the movie has to be the best, but it to me is like everyone's going to be completely awake and focused at 11. Anything after that is a little harder to know.
Yeah. No, that's cool.
Well, okay, so I kicked it back a couple decades for this, and I'm going to go Blood and Black Lace,
ooh,
Mr. Mario Bava from 1964. So this is like my favorite Bava film, I think. It's incredibly stylish. It's sort of a predecessor to the Giallo films, a predecessor to slasher films.
And Argento color scheme-wise, right?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. The movie, in terms of the style, it's not only shadows and light, but it's also tons of colored light, gels on just about every scene. There's a green light or a blue light. The scenes are treated in such a way that it's just gorgeous to look at. But the basic premise is sort of surrounding a fashion house. Like, it's like a place where they put on fashion shows, and a woman is killed, and then there's an investigation, and they find her diary. And suddenly a lot of the people involved in the fashion house place are very interested in that diary because obviously somebody killed her, and they all want to get their hands on the diary. So it becomes kind of like not campy. It's not quite that, but it is a little over the top. I don't want to say it's like Clue or something like that, but it's much darker. A lot of people getting killed, and I don't know. I just love the style of it, ultimately. It's really one of those movies that will get you on the Bava train if you're not a fan of his. It's, I don't know. And there's definitely a shot in there, I remember, from Evil Dead 2 where blood splatters on a light bulb and the bulb swings. Mm. I think that exact shot is in this movie. I'm pretty sure Raimi stole it from this movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's also got a really great killer. He's just a guy who wears like a stocking mask, so he's kind of faceless, and he wears a hat. And I love a movie with a good killer. And lastly, the voice acting in the dub version is done for a couple actors, including Cameron Mitchell, by this guy, Paul Frees, who's the voice of the Haunted Mansion for Disney World.
Oh.
So it's interesting. Sometimes he'll be having a scene with himself where he's dubbing multiple people, and I think that's kind of amusing. And I just love his voice. It's very Halloween-y to me on that level. So So that is Blood and Black Lace.
All right. So far, so good. Now it brings us to 1 a.m.
1 a.m.
Yeah. Okay. It's getting late.
I'm hoping this one will do the trick. I'm going to go with The Pack from 1977, little dog attack movie with Joe Don Baker, patron saint of pure cinema.
Yeah, pretty much.
And
I still haven't seen this one. You talked about this back on, it was a long time ago.
Yeah,
like Revenge, or Animal. It's an animal attacks movie, right?
Yeah, I can't remember where I talked about it, but it's from the director of the Enter the Dragon, and of course Deadly Eyes, which I almost picked for this slot. But
I
talk about that movie too much. I mean, I would definitely sub Deadly Eyes in for this if I didn't talk
little
about
dog rats.
Dog rats. But this is basically an island movie where Jodan Baker plays, I think, a biologist. Incredibly enough, and the Southern island bio. Is like a summer getaway for people, and the idea is that they've come to the island, they bring their dogs, and then they leave their dogs there, which is just incredibly cruel to me. There's actually a scene at the beginning where a dad takes his little boy out to like tie up their dog that they're going to leave because they're going back to the city. It's like the saddest thing. And then that dog, we sort of follow him as he gets involved with the pack, which is this, you know, wild group of dogs that's developed on the island. So they start to go nuts one stormy night, and there's a group of people brought in to do a fishing trip, I think, off the island, and they start getting bumped off, and Jodan gets involved. And I don't know. There's some very Cujo kind of moments, and I'm a big dog person, and maybe there could be some triggers in this movie for people in terms of, like, how well are they treating these dogs? I don't know. But ultimately, I just think dogs are a fun menace. And so a pack of them is, I think, a relatable menace. And I think that's another thing that's cool. Plus, I'm just an animal attack fiend. So ultimately.
Who put that one out?
That's Warner Archive put out a DVD of it, but it's not on Blue yet, unfortunately. So that's fun. My daughter's actually a really big fan of the pack. Okay, nice. She actually asked to watch it like last weekend. It was pretty fun.
She's like 17, I assume.
No. She'd be nine.
Nine? Brian.
The pack is all right for nine.
My gosh.
Yes, for some.
So this is the most dreaded slot, according to Elric.
Yeah,
3 a.m.
3 a.m. slot.
Fifth movie in?
I'm doing my best.
Well, I think everyone's different, but like for me, this is based on me, that's when I'm most tired, and then something happens after that movie around the five where you're suddenly like kind of re-energizing. You're like, it's like passing an endurance where suddenly you're like, oh yeah, okay, now I'm here. I might as well. I'm not getting sleep. Fuck it. So to me, this is the trickiest one. But
Okay.
Well, I was going for noise and music to help keep people awake. I'm going to go with Maximum Overdrive for this slot because it's got obviously a rockin' AC/DC score. But more importantly, and something I'd forgot, is there is these stings that happen that are along the lines of what they do in The Entity with that really oppressive, like, it's just, it's kind of like that when somebody gets killed in Maximum Overdrive. And it happens, I want to say, maybe 3 or 4 times. So I feel like if somebody's nodding off, you get one of these stabs in there and they just kind of kick them
away.
But yeah, I mean, a whole lot of fun, you know, just machines go crazy, soda machines, you know, kill Little League coaches, trucks run people over. Stephen King gets called an asshole by an ATM. I mean, what doesn't this movie have?
And isn't that getting a Blu-ray?
It is. It's getting a nice Blu-ray.
I haven't seen it for a long time. So
yeah, from Vestron. So I'm looking forward. That's actually going to be one I can't wait to get. But yeah, I just thought the music and, you know, the kills would be enough to maybe shake people up and wake them up a little bit. So then what's the next slot here?
That would put us at 5 a.m.
5 a.m. Okay, so for this one, I went with a movie that I like quite a bit by a screenwriter, Mr. Simon Barrett. And it's an earlier movie that I don't feel like enough people talk about for what it is and for the cast. It's called Dead Birds.
Yeah, the Confederate one,
that's
right?
That's a cool one.
Yeah, it's from 2004, I think. It's a really creepy, atmospheric, Civil War-era ghost story. And I think it's really solid. I put it up there with something like Session 9 as far as like being like a sleeper that I think is really effective. Like I rewatched this the other night and it legitimately creeped me out. It's basically about a bunch of robbers who have stolen some gold and they end up at this plantation house next to a really creepy cornfield and something bad has happened in the house and they start to slowly be exposed to what it was through ghostly visions and things like that. I think another thing that's really neat about the movie is the cast, which includes Henry Thomas from E.T., Patrick Fugit, Michael Shannon in an early role, Mark Boone Jr., who I really like a lot, and Isaiah Washington. And, you know, it's a pretty rough role for Michael Shannon, but ultimately he helps, you know, sort of rejuvenate what could be getting tired sort of horror story. I mean, once you get into it, I feel like his character is one of those characters that every time he's on screen, he's just sort of got that Michael Shannon-ness about him. Yeah. That really, I don't know what it is. He's a total asshole in the movie. But
that's a crazy and a lot of TV, like major TV people in there who've gone on to become major.
Yeah,
but like back in the day, I only remembered Henry Thomas from when I saw it.
Yeah, I miss Patrick Fugit. I liked him a lot when he was sort of more commonly used in a lot of movies. So he's really good. But there's just a great way that the ghosts are handled, and they're creepy looking. There's a little, maybe a little CG that could use some work, but ultimately they're pretty creepy, and the way the scares are done, I thought are effective. Like I said, in a way that I don't get creeped out too much by a movie anymore, where I actually have to kind of look over my shoulder a little bit, and this movie had that effect on me. So I'm hoping that in a delirious state, it'll freak people the fuck out, basically.
Yeah, Session 9 was the last time I had that recently, rewatching that. That was the, you know, you yeah, just, that it really
movie,
is atmosphere.
Totally. That movie does it's that to me. Yeah. You know, It Follows does that to me a little bit. Yeah, yeah. The Strangers on some level. Anyway, so that is my 5 a.m. And then lastly, I'm going with something a little bit lighter for the final spot, and that is a movie called Infestation from 2009.
I don't know that one.
It's a killer bug movie, basically. It's like...
Let's get back on speakerphone. Killer bugs?
It's pretty cool. They're giant beetles, basically, and there's also these giant wasps that fly around, but it's like, it starts off like Office Space or something. It starts out like an office comedy, sort of, where this guy is going to be interviewed. Actually, he's going to be fired from his job. And in the middle of it, he and the woman, his boss, who's firing him, they hear this like really loud, like piercing sound. And then they wake up covered in like webs and totally unconscious. And they don't know how long. And then they start to like pull themselves out, and they realize they've been unconscious for days. They've been injected with this like goo in their mouths.
Oh,
and
God.
Anyway, I feel like I might have seen that. Would it have played on Sci-Fi back in the
very
day?
Possibly.
Yeah,
very
I
possibly.
Feel like that description.
It's got Ray Wise in it. That's a big seller.
Yeah, I might have.
Ray
seen
Wise
it,
plays this guy's dad. But basically, this group it becomes sort of like a Night of the Living Dead kind of vibe. They have to go and try and find the nest and save one of their own. But I don't know. I think I just like, again, animals attack, bugs attack.
Yeah.
It's just got that sort of slightly Tremors vibe, slightly, you know, comedic, but still effectively horror, especially the idea of getting wrapped in webs and stuff is just kind of creepy to me. And bugs are creepy to me. So I don't know. But this one I feel like is pretty underseen. I think it's on Amazon Prime, actually, if people want to check that out.
Yeah, this one I'm not familiar with. I mean, I know there's a million movies called
Infestation
or
Infest,
yeah, somewhere
whatever.
Along those lines. But no, that looks like fun.
So read off in order.
Yeah, let's go.
Just so we can
that's,
hear.
That's a good all-nighter.
Yeah, okay. Let's hear the order.
So we start with Curse of the Demon. We go to I'm Madman, followed by Blood and Black Lace, followed by The Pack, followed by Maximum Overdrive, and then Dead Birds, and finally Infestation.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, that's like got every tone. I like it. You're hitting all the notes.
Trying to.
Man.
The sweet spots.
All righty, Elric, you ready to rock and roll?
All right, let's do it.
Because I have no idea what you would do. I feel like I may be the only predictable one, because I went all fun, kind of like that's all I want. I was like, this is what I would do.
Well, I definitely
it's hard for me to stay up all night. So
I might be different if I was really programming, but I don't program like just to my taste. I know, like what I always go, okay, what do I want to see?
I program to my taste.
I do a bit, but it's like there's a couple. Anyway, I want to kick off at 7 p.m. These are always based on like the things I've liked at other all-nighters. So
yeah.
7 p.m. when I sit down, that's when I want to go balls to wall from day. Like I want to sit down and I think one of them I got to see Fright Night 2 or something.
Yeah.
So super fun. So I'm going to start my night with Friday 13th Part 6, Jason Lives. I want to see lightning hitting the thing. I want everyone, you know.
Great
I just like because the thing what you get when you do that at an all-nighter is everyone just fucking cheers out of their seats because it's something familiar.
Yeah.
And it's in it. And I was thinking of the sequels, which on 4 to me is still my favorite movie like in terms of a narrative, but 6 is a lot more fun, and that's the one I think that's going to get people hopping.
Yeah. I have seen it on the big screen, and it's a tremendous reaction.
Yeah.
I think it's the most crowd-pleasing of all the Fridays.
It's Tom McLaughlin, who we're a big fan of. It's 86. It's just super fun. I think that'd be a great way to get things started. And then like Brian, I this is coming from the New Beverly model. They always put in the first 3, I think, a classic movie, because you don't want to do it too late, obviously. So to me, 9's a good spot for that. So even though I thought of the same one of you, Curse, this is similar. This is The Devil Rides Out.
Nice.
My favorite Hammer film. Terrence Fisher, director, a classic director. This one would be a 9. And it's not so classic that it needs to, you know, it's still 70s. This one actually is playing in LA for Friday Night Frights. Is playing it somewhere in the next few days. So look out for that. If you've never seen that, this is like, to me, the only Hammer. I like a lot of Hammer films, but this is the only one where I kind of love it. Christopher Lee, it's you know, a bunch of people sitting in a room for a lot of it, but it actually goes somewhere by the end, and you actually like delivers on the promise of Satanism, devil worship, and has like one of the most kind of indelible visions of the devil, I think, in a movie. But it's also just it's a really smart film, and films where people are sitting around circularly talking about devils and don't often work for me. This one does.
Yeah, that's top three Hammer for me.
Yeah, I'm sure. And for Fisher in general is so good. I haven't seen it for a long time, so I do remember it's a Richard Matheson script.
Yeah.
Dennis Wheatley is the book. Anyway, so that's 7 and 9. So get people moving, then get them thinking. Now, this is when Elric's taste fully comes in. This is one I've always wanted to see at an all-nighter. A movie that made me the man I am today at 11 p.m., Body Parts. Eric Reds. To me, this is one of the most fun fucking movies. Like, at one point, I was like, The Hidden's so fucking good. I should play The Hidden. And then I'm like, no, Body Parts.
Because
Body Parts made me study criminology. I feel like I've told the story on the show before, but I was a kid. I was probably like 13, 14, and I was watching a movie on VHS, and the trailer for, not even the movie, the trailer to Body Parts.
Yeah.
In the trailer, they're like, he's a criminologist. And I was like, I want to be like that. So I hadn't even seen the movie when I had decided in my head. So I did study that university based on Body Parts.
Jeff Fahey is your hero.
Jeff Fahey was so awesome. And there's something
wrong with that.
Also, I'm a big fan of, like, you know, because we all know the genius of Soul Man and the basketball scene in Soul Man being one of the great
of
basketball scenes. The only thing that can top C. Thomas Howell not being able to play basketball as a fake black man is Body Parts, where basically, for those who don't know, I'm assuming that everyone knows Body Parts, and I know that's not the case. Jeff Fahey gets in a really horrible accident and gets a arm surgically attached to him in a new procedure. And that's just fantastic. And he's super lucky. But then he kind of starts having weird feelings, and he goes to kind of like, I think, a recovery center for people who have had this. And there's a basketball game going on where a guy got the legs donate to them. They don't realize. I'm not sure at this point. I can't remember story wise if this is a point where, like, you know, they're the same. They came from the same person. I can't recall. But the guy's like dunking and stuff. It's like, because he's got great legs now. And then later on, Brad Dourif is a artist who has gotten. I can't remember if he's the other arm from the same person, but he's painting really graphic, dark art that he didn't make before. Anyway, the basic story is, at a certain point, we realize they have all inherited body parts of a serial killer whose head and body in the main torso is still being kept alive, and at a certain point comes back to get his body. It's so fucking fun. And it's not on Blu-ray. And I think, and Eric Red, to me, like, Eric Red's obviously the great screenwriter of Near Dunk. Another film I thought about putting on this list, which would be the ultimate middle of the night movie, is The Hitcher. Like, that will keep anyone awake.
That almost made mine,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, totally. It's such a good freaking movie. But Body Parts is really unique. And people just don't talk about it enough, probably because it's not on Blu-ray. Jeff Fahey, he's really good, but there is a scene where the car pulls up to him and the guy wants his arm back, and he does something to try to get his arm back, and you're just like, this is about as good as movies could be, right? like having two people square off like this, and as a total, it goes total bonkers by the end. So, like, you get a really satisfying end to this film. But Eric Red's a guy, you know, a lot of personal, professional, some strange life stuff happened in his career, but he, in the couple movies he made some really fucking good movies, really dark material, and this is a lot of fun. So for me, this is the most me on this list.
That's
you'll have a good time at 11 to 8 p.m. You're getting, it's to me, that's a nice balls to the wall spot. 11
how
PM.
Do you follow that up at one?
This one is gonna lose everyone, but one thing I really, okay, so what's important to me, this is the there always has to be one movie, and it's happened to me every time I've gone to all nighter, there's usually one movie that I've never heard of. There's like one thing, and it plays at a weird time. You're like, and it keeps you awake because you're like, what is this? Like, it's just usually it's some weird discovery, some straight to video, some exploitation. For me, this one has gotten a little bit of press. I wanted to highlight it because it's now HD on Amazon. It's saying it's a Code Red title now, and this is an early slasher called The Redeemer, Son of Satan.
Yeah, yeah.
It's from 78. It's not a great movie by any means, but I think at an all-nighter it'd be particularly interesting because it is, I mean, 78, it's early slasher, and yet it hits all the formulaic beats that you would expect by a guy called Konstantin S. Gochis. But the thing is, I looked the guy up, couldn't find any other movies. So maybe it's a pseudonym, but it's a bunch of friends are back for a 10-year high school reunion, and when they get there, they all got invites. When they get there, they realize they're the only 10 people there, and now they're trapped inside the high school, and the deaths are really creative. There's actually one I remember being like, oh, that's fucking cool. So I'd say it's closest – in that way to The Mutilator in terms of cool deaths, not great movie, but it's, I feel like The Mutilator is really bad dramatically. Like, yeah, the, you know, the acting, this isn't as bad as that. But what makes this film unique is it starts and ends in a way that is so unexplainable. It basically, it opens with this kid walking out of the sea or a giant lake. So basically, it's positing that he's like the devil. So, when you're in the most of the thrust of this movie is pure slasher, and I won't say who's the slasher, but it's kind of, there's a preacher quality and there's like the devil. So you're watching this movie going, I don't understand the start and end of this movie in the context of the bulk of the movie. But it does give it this weird quality, and it kind of ends in the same ways where you're like, oh, what is this about? I got to watch it again myself because I only saw it the one time and I was definitely left going, that's a really interesting movie. So if I saw that at 1 a.m., I think I'd be like, oh, I bet half the audience would be silent, like, what? I can't remember what they shared some Bigfoot anthology thing a couple years back, Screams of a Winter Night, and it was like not a good movie, but because no one had heard of it, like, besides Brian Collins, I was like the whole time going, what is this? And your brain gets a little more engaged. Yeah. That takes me to 3M, a key spot. I did the complete opposite, and this is the only one I'm stealing from one of the most influential moments I've had at a movie, which I was at a 24-hour movie marathon, and at 3 a.m. or somewhere around there in New Zealand, Ant Timpson, as the first time I'd seen it, played City of the Living Dead by Fulci. And instead of waking you up, it did the opposite. It made me fucking hallucinate. Like, yeah. I was watching images in that movie going, what? And then like half drifting off and then waking up and seeing like people puking guts. It's just like utterly yeah. haunting, that movie. Seeing it, and I hadn't seen it before. So I was super lucky in my life to get to see it in that way. And so for me, you know, it's also one of my favorite movies, but just putting that at 3 a.m., it's like, yeah, you might fall asleep, but fuck it. You're like, you're going to see something that's going to fuck with you. And there's so many images in that movie. And the great thing about Fulci, the highs are as high as anyone in cinema's history, yeah. and the lows are just pretty low. Yeah. But they're all in the same movie.
Yeah, so I was gonna say, sometimes you get them in the same
yeah,
movie.
and I can live with that because the highs are so good. So I think that'll be a really interesting 3 a.m. 5 a.m. is, you know, that, again, a pretty tricky spot. I wanted something that's less seen. This isn't, I wouldn't say necessarily a great movie. I call this Poor Man's Messiah of Evil. And that is, I recently got a kind of a new release. I think it's a really fun movie and not talked about, and that's called Mutant. John Bud Cardos, 84. But all you need to know about it is a little actor called Ramrod.
No way.
Wingshauser and his buddy and his brother, they're just kind of two brothers hiking along, and they come to some town. It definitely fits in the Carnival of Souls, Messiah of Evil, like kind of style, but done in an 80s, like trying to be entertaining. It, some parts of it are kind of slow, but when these kind of, they're kind of like, I've read on different things, some people are calling them zombies, some people are calling them vampires. I don't think it's ever really clear. I know they've been turned by toxic waste in this town, but people start getting infected and start trying to stop them from being able to get out of the town. But it's got that same, it'd be super fun to watch like at 5 a.m. because you're just watching these two guys having fun, and then suddenly it starts becoming this, oh, the whole town's coming after us and they're all zombies or whatever they are. But this is when, I think because the title's so bad, like the title is totally not, this film could, you know, should be called They Follow, or, you know, like It Follows or something. But the title Mutant makes it feel like it's a monster, a singular monster. And that is not this movie. So if you, is this a Code Red or Scorpion?
It's a Code Red. And funnily enough, I bought it, but I haven't watched it.
No, it's really fun.
But if you had ever said Poor Man's Messiah of Evil, I would have thrown it on that night.
Yeah, no, seriously. I think this would be a really fun people.
That's his selling point.
That's my song. And Wingshauser
should love that
sell
movie.
Itself. You know?
Yeah, well, and then Wingshauser.
Wingshauser in this kind of a film. And from 84. It's like perfect. But to me, this is a really fun one. I've only seen it one time, so that's why I'm a little vague. Sometimes I put them on because I want to see it. I almost, the only alternate I had here was I was going to play Spookies, but my answer was going to be because I haven't seen it. I literally wanted to see a movie I've never seen before.
I think everybody would have been angry.
I know. I haven't done it. So I didn't do that. And then I'm ending, to wrap it up, this is very, very typical of me, and Brian has probably even me hitting the drum on this one more than anyone, but also on the show, I think the best movie experience I've ever had to end one of these was Miracle Mile at a film fest. It was that same 24-hour one. I'm not picking Miracle Mile, but when it ended, it's all so apocalyptic, and I walked out and the sun was just coming up, yeah. and I had this like, it's like an amazing reaction to it. Like, that is how you wanted it. So I need to end with that, and the movie I want to do that is Just Before Dawn.
Ooh.
Because to me, the way that movie ends and the way she survives, we're not going to spoil it, it's one of my favorite Final Girl survivors, yeah, but the 100%. Way the light, because it's called Just Before Dawn, the way the light starts kind of coming up at the end, I feel like if that was the last thing you saw at your all-nighter and you've survived just like she has, using anything you can to survive the movie, you walk out after that at 9 a.m. or whatever and you have survived, I think that would be a really cool end movie.
Yeah,
so, and I love that as incredible. A slasher. So that's your run. So real quickly.
Go through them again from
Friday 13th, 7 p.m., Friday 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives. 9 p.m., The Devil Rides Out. 11 p.m., Body Parts. 1 a.m., The Redeemer, Son of Satan. 3 a.m., City of the Living Dead. 5 a.m., Mutant. And 7 a.m., Just Before Dawn.
Wow.
And somewhere in there, I was thinking, I got to play Dead Alive, got to play Dead Alive, got to play Dead, but I didn't. So
that's next year's.
I resisted.
All right. Mine aren't going to really need that much explanation because I went for some... basically, my approach was, all right, it's October, it's Halloween season. My all-nighter is going to be all fun and all things that kind of encompass the Halloween holiday for me. And so I'm going to kick it off at 7 p.m. with a classic. I'm going to go right into Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
I knew you had to.
Because I want to kick it off. I want you to remember all the original monsters.
It's a great way to start.
So it's like, this is the movie that's got them all. Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman. And it's just fun. And so that's the way to kick it off. And then at 9 p.m., I want to continue that thread, and I'm going to go right into the Monster Squad. Because, I mean, look, it's Halloween night. It's like, oh, I got the Universal Monster movies with Abbott and Costello. Now I have the 80s version of it with all these kids. And so that one's a lot of fun. Everyone knows it already. We get to 11 p.m. This is where you're starting to tire a little. But like you said, you need that one movie that's going to charge you. And to me, the quintessential Freddy movie is A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors.
Oh, nice.
So if you think about it, you got the Universal Monsters in two different iterations. And then at 11 p.m., just that opening sequence when Patricia Arquette's running away and he comes sliding in the background, coming towards you. It's like it's the 11 p.m. like, holy shit, yes, I forgot how much I love this movie.
And Freddy's the closest to being a universal character that we've
pretty
ever
much
had.
Yeah. Because
Michael Myers isn't, Jason isn't. They're not like those. But he's like somewhere between the Invisible Man and, I don't know, one of the other.
Yeah.
With the personality.
So that's the 11 p.m. slot. Now we're past midnight. It's 1 a.m. It's Halloween season. I like the Freddy's kind of a classic, so I'm going to go with Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers.
Yes.
I am going to go there because that one on its own is kind of ridiculous and fun. And it kind of encompasses everything about Halloween. It opens up with the legend of Michael Myers, and then he's back. He's poking thumbs in people's foreheads and just killing people.
And you get Danielle.
And you get Danielle Harris.
Yeah, she's really good in that one. I really like that one.
Yeah, so I feel like, you know, we're going from the classic monsters to modern monsters to Freddy to Michael Myers. Now we're to the 3 a.m. slot. This is the tough one because you're going to lose a lot of people now. And I felt like I wanted to give them a huge release, a huge laugh. I'm giving him Frankenhooker.
I
feel at that point you've seen Frankenstein. Let's give you another version of it.
And I think he's the ultimate late night director, Hanlotta. Because I thought about Basket Case as well.
I thought about Brain Dead. I mean Brain Damage.
Brain Damage.
Yeah, I mean the Hanlotta. You got to put him right in there. And so we're at 3 a.m. Now we're at 5 a.m. This is you're delirious. The whole night is kind of weird. This was almost my 3 a.m. slot movie, but I was like, you know what? No, I want Frankenhooker because that's fun and people can. You don't really need to pay attention much to it. You could pass out a little bit. But at 5 a.m. when you're delirious, I'm going to hit you with some time travel and time crimes, which would be the 2007 movie by Nacho Vigilango.
That would be a great head scratcher at that time, like people piecing it together.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. I think then you're kind of like a little delirious. You're not sure what's going on. You've seen all these great classic monsters, and then that one comes at you, and you're like, what is this?
That's a great movie.
Yeah, that movie's fantastic.
So that will bring us into the morning, and at 7 a.m., serving coffee and donuts, I want to reward the audience with The Final Girls.
Which
to me just seems like a great culmination of everything we just did before it. You know, it's like,
and it's cinema,
pure cinema. It's at a retro theater, and you kind of get to. It's almost like a great punchline to everything you've seen before.
Yeah,
and I just feel like you can walk out of The Final Girls and be like, man, that was a fun night.
Yeah,
just a pure fun night. So once again, 7 p.m. Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. At 9 p.m. we'll do the Monster Squad. 11 p.m. is Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. 1 a.m., Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers. 3 a.m., Frankenhooker. 5 a.m., we got Time Crimes. And lastly, at 7 a.m., The Final Girls.
And once again, if anyone does any of these,
no,
we will
don't
give you
don't
some
promise
sort of
things.
Well, if you live in America, I would give you some sort of prize. You'd have to prove that you had done this for real as an all-nighter. It can't just be like over a week that you watch these movies. It has to be in succession.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But that's good. And I will say that I think all three of those completely show our personalities.
Yeah, 100%. You know what you're getting with us.
Yeah, that's right. Very cool.
If you didn't think this show could get any better, this episode, which hopefully you're enjoying it so far.
And we still hope, I mean, we don't have any confirmation this is about to happen, but we hope that when we go out of this room, there will be a really
great guest. You're going to hear ads, and after that, hopefully.
There'll be a great guest.
Hopefully.
We hope.
We'll be right back.
Yeah.
This week's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by the new RLJ Entertainment release, Housewife. After Holly meets with the notorious cult leader Bruce O'Hara, she's led on a twisted journey of waking dreams that begin to unravel the fabric of her reality. Take a trip down the rabbit hole in this visually stunning film from the director of Baskin. Housewife is now available on DVD, VOD, and digital. Get it on Amazon.com today.
Fangoria is back. Resurrected just in time for this Halloween, the magazine that set the standard is coming back as a deluxe 100-page quarterly edition. Set visits, deep dives, new discoveries, fiction, and exclusive artwork. Specific contents are being kept under wraps for now because Fangoria wants you to experience true analog nostalgia when you open that black poly bag and see what's inside for the very first time. But it's not just a magazine anymore. Fangoria is also bringing you novels under its Fangoria Presents label, and Fango is also getting into the movie biz. Be sure to check out their recent release, Puppet Master, The Littlest Reich. Head to Fangoria.com and subscribe to Fangoria. A subscription of $60 will save you about $20 off the cover price. That's Fangoria.com. Subscribe now.
All right, welcome back to the show. We are very excited because Elric just saw this gentleman do a Q&A at Beyond Fest.
Yes.
And you said it was wonderful.
It was wonderful. There was some great stories, but also it was just amazing to see Scanners on the big screen, especially for some of these key moments that have become iconic and have become copied off GIFs and just, you know, shared in a way that you don't get the whole context. And when you see these scenes play out in the context of a movie, you forget how surprising they are and how the build-up's so interesting. So, yes. And also just an actor whose work I've always been drawn to, the intensity of a lot of the early roles where you just, I don't know, it's...
You have problems sleeping then.
I do have problems. And sometimes I was very relieved to know that you had a nice Canadian accent, so that helps.
No way.
We're joined by the great Michael Ironside. Welcome.
How you doing? And with me is the director of Knuckleball, Michael Peterson.
Hello, Michael. Welcome.
Hey, thanks. Thanks, guys. Nice to meet you.
And when this airs, the film that you guys did together will be officially out on VOD and DVD Friday, October 5th.
Knuckleball.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. So we're actually going to see it in the theaters tomorrow night, Friday night.
Friday
on Sunset. Right. There's a few prints floating around.
So how did you end up in his film?
The way I remember it, and I swear to God, maybe I'm wrong, is I remember getting the script sent to me through a mutual friend. I had not heard from Mike. I don't know who Mike was. I read the script. I actually read it twice, and then I called you, and then we met when you were down here for
AFM or something.
We met for a breakfast.
Yeah, yeah.
And immediately hit it off because they're both of our concepts on the script were the very same. Very similar.
But we actually met about 12, 15 years before
that. That's right.
In L.A., driving down the road.
Down Laurel Canyon. I was driving down Laurel Canyon. You were in a pickup truck with a camper thing on the back, and I saw the Alberta license plates. Right?
Yeah, and he rolled down his window and was like, "Hey, are you from Canada?" And I'm like, "Hey, yeah, you're Michael Ironside. I'm a big fan of your stuff."
Wow.
Then I think you're thinking of an episode of Strange Brew. It's a great show.
It happened just above Hollywood on going south on Laurel Canyon. Oh, wow. I remember that. Isn't that funny? And I
told him I'd call him one day when I have the right role for him.
Right. And it took, what, 15 years?
Yeah, I'm a slow writer.
Well, tell us a little bit about this, because you co-wrote this script, right?
Yes.
And so what is this story, and why was this the one that felt right to make right now?
A big part of it is just being a parent and the anxiety of not being able, you know, you're worried you're not going to be able to protect your kids. That's where a lot of it starts from, right? Mm-hmm. You know, a big part of being a parent is being afraid that you're going to fuck it up, basically.
These guys know. I don't.
Sounds a little bit like The Brood, you know, tying it back to Cronenberg.
And maybe that's a Canadian thing. I don't know. Maybe we're all scared of that. But I think it's pretty
universal.
Pretty universal, right? So that's definitely where it started from.
Mm-hmm. And did you have him in mind for Grandpa when you wrote this?
That one I didn't have anyone specifically in mind when we wrote it. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. This time we didn't. And then when I was thinking about people for that would be great for the role, Ironside came to mind, and it just kind of clicked and ossified and became the thing.
What I
hopefully, you know, thankfully he liked it.
He's not only liked it, I read it. And what I remember is when we went to breakfast that morning, I read the script and I realized that, to me, it articulated the fact that the biggest problem we have in the universe right now is and I've said this in other interviews, that we've never had more opportunities, whether it's cell phones or computers or you know, God help us, Twitter, that we have ways of communicating. So little is being said and so little connection is happening. And it articulated the lack of communication within a family from generation and within the first 5 minutes, you see exactly what the film's about. You have that you drop out of the sky into this barren landscape inside this car that you're now driving, that he copped the car after the movie. And you have a husband who's talking and nobody's really listening to him. You have a wife and a mother who's taking medication for anxieties and bitching about things and everything, who are going off to have a holly, you know, to have a bit of a vacation while they're at a funeral. And you have the son in the back on his video, playing a video game on his cell phone, trying to listen and not listen and be invisible to the point where they almost miss the turnoff. And that's the whole film right there. It's about, for me, it's the lack of communication. And I told Mike, I was absolutely blown away by the script when I read it. I actually read it twice. And we seem to be on the same page right off the bat.
Yeah, I think you tested me.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to make sure that you were you. You'd be surprised. I mean, when you meet, you know, when we first met, it was, yeah, I wanted to know whether you were competent or not.
Well, thankfully that worked out.
Seriously, I know that now, but I mean.
I passed.
Well, oh, Jesus, we're going to get sensitive on the air. No, it was, it's a fabulous script, and I was absolutely blown away by its end product. Okay. Like, I don't do this a lot. I swear to God, I'm not here to blow smoke up your ass. You know, it's like I'm not here. I don't go out and support a film very often. Mm-hmm. I think this film's worth seeing. When we've taken it to film festivals, I've been to film festivals with films before, and half the audience leaves, and a bunch of jerks sit around and want me to sign posters and stuff and like that. This film, people stay, whether they're 76 or 16, and they all have the same reaction, which is it's not what I expected. Wow, and it affects them in some, you know, in some kind of organic, on some kind of organic level. We made choices in the film that, like, the first time my daughter and I are in the same frame, we look at each other and I look her up and down. We don't touch. There's no touching. There's no hugging. The first true organic hug happens when the grandson comes up and I put my arm around him and say, just go on. You'll be fine with me, you know. And it's about, for me, it's about how much trouble we are in the world right now, that nobody really ever communicates. Nobody ever feels safe. We've got suicide rates are up, violence is up, everything's up, and yet we have so many ways of communicating and nothing is being said. And we get rid of the only cell phone in form of communication in the first 5 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
You know, I love this film. I really do. I think it's worth seeing.
That sounds interesting. We haven't seen the film yet, so we're
and it's scary.
It
comes out the day that this comes out.
Yeah, yeah.
How often does a piece of material like this, you know, like when you're looking for, because it's a lot of your time to invest into being a part of a project. But how often does a piece of material like this really speak to you? Because it seems like this one means a lot to you.
I've had a pretty fortunate career. I get to do at least one project or two projects to affect my distribution, keep me viable so I can find a smaller project and help affect it, you know, help it with its distribution, be able to get on the radio because of my name and stuff and talk about it. And I also accept unsolicited scripts. If you're out there, make sure they're copywritten before you send them to me because I won't read them if they're not. And I do not to this day know how I got this script. Do you?
Kurt Harder, who's a buddy of mine, and I brought on board to produce and produced a film called Stillborn that you were in with him and Colin Minahan.
Because I got it through somebody else. I didn't get it directly from you, did I?
I think Kurt sent it to you because you guys had just done something together. You were out there at that one-day role for the psychologist or something.
Because I get anywhere up from 30, sometimes 50 unsolicited scripts a month. Whoa. And I'll read them, and it all depends on how much, I think, political turmoil there is in the world on how many scripts I get. And very few of them actually resonate with me. If I'm lucky, 1 in 50. And this was 1 in 50. I read it twice. And then you meet the people involved. And if they don't come up to snuff, you say, well, good luck with this, you know. But this one did. This one was.
Do they have to have funding before you would even read it?
No.
Okay, so you might get attached. And
no,
interesting.
No, I can use it. I can help. Up to $1.5 million or $1 million, I can help with funding and stuff. Because there's a certain amount of distribution that's guaranteed with me and a certain amount of interest, you know, so.
Is that how you've always done it, just out of curiosity?
Not always, but how do I say this politely? I got tired of sort of supporting shit, you know, and I actually got suicidal on a film I was on. I won't mention the film. This is years and years and years ago where I just thought, what the fuck am I doing here? You know, I'm away from my wife, my children, my family, you know, everything I want to be doing. And I'm going out supporting people who basically, you know, lead with their dick, you know. And it was really, really not fun. And I really do respect my craft. I like what I do with it and stuff. And I felt like a whore. I just felt like I had sold myself down the river. And I remember getting together with my wife and my older daughter at the time and saying, I can't do this anymore. I've got to find a way. So we made a decision to change our way of doing things. Made a decision to change the way we make films. This was mid-80s, around 87, 88. And so I try and just affect distribution with a project every year. Last year it was the Alienist, that TV series. And stuff like that, which a fabulous show. Well written. And then I get to run off and do little things. And every once in a while, you hit one out of the park. And with this film, Knuckleball, is really one of those films.
You mentioned craft. So I don't really know where, even from the Q&A the other day, I don't really know where your craft began and where your journey.
I'm a writer-director. I started off in art college. I had my first play produced when I was 17. I was a very precocious little prick from the East End of Toronto. I was actually writing my life story at 14.
Wow.
and the student teacher, Judy Millen, if she's out there and hears this, God love you, she took me aside and said, what are you writing? And I told her, and she said, do you mind if I read it? And she read it. She said, you know, your structure and your personalities and the stories you're telling with this are absolutely mind-boggling. She says, but your descriptive narrative is shit. Have you ever thought of writing a play or something like that? And at that age, all I knew was what the high schools gave us. I said, you mean like Shakespeare or Ibsen? And she gave me a whole bunch of more contemporary plays where I realized I could like have 3 pages of description to completely control the situation, have 1 line of dialogue, and then go on from there. And we took 2 chapters in my biography where I ran away from home after a family party and stuff like that and stayed at the Salvation Army in Toronto when I was 14 and saw a guy get killed in the washroom and nobody cared.
Yeah, wow.
And I wrote that and turned it into a play called The Shelter. And not telling me anything, here I am at 14 and a half, 15, she entered in an account. She was one of these rebellious student teachers that always wants to change the system. She sent it off to a play competition, but it was at the university level, not at the grade school level, and I won first prize. And I came home, I also had a full-time job at night in those days, and I came home one day and there was all these men in our house, our little 12 and a half foot row housing in East End of Toronto, and they all had their hats on, so I thought it was the police, you know, and that's how old I am. They were wearing fedoras, you know. When I got home that night, my dad was waiting for me, and he usually goes to bed about 11:30 at night after the news. And he said, he told me what had happened. I said, oh, shit, what, did I do something wrong? He said, no. He said, your teacher seems to want to make a point that funding should be at a more, you know, grassroots level, not to a finished product that's coming out of university. And the first prize is $5,000, and you get a workshop or a company of your choice to put on your play, and you get free access to Hart House Theater at University of Toronto for the rest of your life. And I said, oh, geez, what do I do? He says, well, if you split that up, they'll let you. And I swear to God, only about 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, I realized this is my father who had never seen $5,000 in one place in his whole life. Very well read, but only a grade 3 education. And he said, you can always make money. Why don't you take the production so you can see your piece on stage and have access to Hard House? And I said, and I remember saying, yeah, that's cool. Because they split the money between second and third because they seemed to be all nervous about the money. He said, yeah, and I went to bed and he went to bed. And it never hit me until a couple of years ago that my father made that decision, you know, and forever, I think, changed my life.
Yeah.
Because I got to see my play on stage and something happened. And it really did. And I ended up joining the National Film Board in Canada. I was invited to join as a writer-director in 1969-1970 in a workshop of writers, directors, and actors. I went as a writer-director, took acting training for all of us, a new way of doing things under a teacher called Janine Manatis, and came out as an actor. And when I realized I was an actor, I was somebody – I did Look Back in Anger live to the camera on the CBC. And Janine, the teacher, said, we're going to do this, and we're going to do it our way and stuff like that. And I went, okay, I want you to play Porter, which was the lead. And I thought, she knows what she's doing. I'm a director. I guess I can do it. And when it was over, I got a call from this agent named Laurie Rodenberg at the time. He's passed now, one of the bigger agents in Canada. And he said, I'd like to represent you. I was at the workshop, the National Film Board workshop, hanging lights for the show that night for a production we were putting on. And I said, what do you mean you want to represent me? I have representation. And he said, well, that's for writing. And I said, well, what the fuck do you want? And he said, for acting. And I said, who the fuck is this? Who is it? I said, Brian Freeman, is this you? And I hung up. So Janine comes in and says, did you hang up on Laurie Rodenberg? I said, well, that really was him. He's out of his mind. He wants to represent me as an actor. And she said, he does. And I went, I'm not an actor. I'm a writer-director. And she said, what the fuck do you think I've been teaching you for 3 years? And I thought she was out of her mind. And we went and saw John Huston's boxing film, Stacy Keach.
Fat City.
Went and saw Fat City that night. Went to see Fat City that night. And I was in the audience with my brother-in-law. We were watching. And it's the scene in the bar where he picks her up and she picks him up. Yeah. And he's sitting there and I'm watching this scene where he goes, and my brother-in-law, Marty, God love him, he's been my best friend since I was 7. We're sitting there watching this. And he walks over and she says, get the fuck away from me. And he goes over to the jukebox, puts the money in, and says, you can count on me. And bam, smashes his head on the jukebox and says, you can count on me. Bam, smashes it. And then after he did it, I was thinking, well, that's really interesting. I wouldn't have done it that way, but that's kind of interesting. And when I realized what I had thought, I literally threw up. I threw up between my legs in the theater. And I ran out, and Marty came out with me. He says, what's wrong? And I went, I'm not a fucking actor. I don't think And he says, I'm not going back in. We're going to see the whole thing from the beginning. We're going to wait till the next showing. He's very much an Al-Anon. And that's when I first realized I was an actor.
That's fascinating.
And it changed. And I went in and talked to Janine the next day and started acting.
Up until that point, had movies played any role in your life?
Constantly. Yeah. Constantly. They'd all been my way of measuring myself, you know. My father used to take me to the Bonita Theater. It was a neighborhood little, you know, on Wednesday nights you could get in for 15 cents. And he'd teach me life lessons, you know. And all I saw was the movies. I talk about it's the tribal existence of when the lights go down and the fire comes up, you all tell stories around it, whether it's turn of the century or tribally back, you know, when Christ was born or something. Or whether it's now, you know, you go into a theater, the lights go down, the lights come up, and you sit there and you're told a story. And you suspend reality. Mm. You're allowed – you come – a good film, you leave your body. You're not there. You're in the film and you get that respite. You get an opportunity to not be worried or not be in your life and not have to deal with everything. And when a project does a good job, it gives the audience that opportunity.
Speaking of leaving your body, that is a scanner segue. FYI. I mean, you had already acted in a lot of films before that opportunity, but that's obviously one that made you an international appeal and made this I assume a bankable actor. But how did you become involved in that? Because it's a role.
As I'm looking at you with a Cronenberg.
I'm wearing a Cronenberg for present.
Yeah, I was hired for one day's work on the film, as I remember it.
I was hired. So in the script of that film, Darryl Revick, who is what we all remember about that movie. was meant to be a one-day player.
As far as I know, I wish David I could have a conversation with David. I missed him the other night when he was at the festival. But I remember being – the way I remember it is – and that's, fuck, what,
yeah, it's 40
years
ago.
Now,
I think, yeah. It's crazy.
I was hired just to do the black and white flashback sequence. Of me sitting when to they were going to use him to, and I think Larry Dane, who's the head of security, was originally going to be the protagonist lead at some point.
So the other bad guy,
the other bad guy
directed Heavenly Bodies, another Canadian movie.
Wow. He was going to be the guy, and yeah. David started rewriting it, and that's Cronenberg's talent. I mean, can you? I know he did a lot of rewriting on the run because I got scenes to play and stuff that sometimes I got the night before, sometimes I got them the morning of.
Wow.
You know, and the bad thing, if there is a bad thing about the film, I joked about it the other night, was I was paid scale as a one day performer. I made 5,700 and change Canadian on that film. I remember I was at the dinner with Jennifer Neal and her husband at the time.
The lead actress from it, yeah.
Yeah, Jennifer Neal from Summer 42. And, gorgeous woman. And we're having dinner, and she said, what are you buying the crew for Christmas? This is the December 23rd. And I said, buying the crew for Christmas? I'm trying to steal my fucking wardrobe.
And, and it was a pretty good suit.
And her husband said to me, what are you making on this film? And I said, 53 and change. He said, Canadian or American? I said, Canadian. He said, a week? And I went, no, for the whole film. And I looked at her, and they were like, staring holes in their soup. And I said, what are you making? She said, I think at the time it was 55 or 57. I said, American, huh? She said, yeah. And I said, a week. And they nodded. And I realized it was like $370,000 or something. And I went, that's a lot of money.
How does that happen?
And I was sitting there, and they said, is there anything we can do? We feel so bad. And I said, yeah, you can pay for dinner and buy another fucking drink. And But you know what? I was absolutely grateful to get that money at that time.
Yeah.
You know, but did visiting hours after that. And then the same company that did that produced Scanners and Visiting Hours, Claude Roux and the people out of Montreal, offered me a film at scale plus 10 after those two films. And one of the guys that was involved said, if you're any good, you wouldn't be here.
Huh.
Because Canadians. And yeah. I went, you know, you're absolutely right. I packed a bag and was gone a week later.
Wow.
Because I thought if I want to be paid, I have to go where the money's being paid.
Yeah.
And literally, I was in Los Angeles less than 3 weeks, and I was offered tons of money back in Canada. It's the Canadian personality to think we're lesser than in public.
Well, that's a tall poppy syndrome. I'm from New Zealand, and it's a very similar problem. Once you make it overseas, they take you back.
There was one of those guys in Mad Magazine said, Canadians are just like everyone else in the world, dully dressed to go outside.
Yeah.
And
as
I look at us.
So you were, if you were meant to be a one day, was it, do you think it was your presence as an actor that what you brought to the character that made him kind of rethink?
I can't speak for David's mind. I know that scene has when I auditioned, that's what I auditioned was for that scene. Mm. And he made a decision after the audition. When we actually shot the scene, the actress that was supposed to play the doctor that's interrogating Daryl didn't show up. And we were kind of stuck. They were actually going to shoot it as a full scene. And I don't know if David remembers this or not, but I said, just get the continuity lady, put her a white jacket, have her read the lines off the script, because we were really tight for time and for money and time. I said, just shoot it in one angle as if it's a security video. And he said, oh, that's a great idea. So we did that. And I told her, when I pick up the glass of water and pour it out, get the fuck out of the way because I'm going to throw the glass. And that's why she gets up and runs out and throw it. And I didn't know whether she'd gotten out of the way. And if you ever notice in the film, I throw the glass, then I look up to see if anyone was hurt with the glass, and I put my head back down again. And we shot the insert of him taking the bandage off. That was shot, I think, almost 6 months later, 7 months later.
So the legendary scene, and you did tell a story the other day about the scene that's just been copied and it's one of the best head explosions imaginable. But walk me through what was being asked of you for that scene, because that's a pretty amazing
the Louis Del Grandi scene.
Yeah,
when he gets
the head
blown up.
When you the first time it's also a great dramatic scene. I think sometimes people overlook because the effect's so good. The effect's only good because the performances leading up to that were so surprising. Because you appear to just be some guy in the crowd, and he reticently gets up to be part of to be scanned, and then of course you take the upper hand. It's like over the top with Stallone or something. You end up like blowing his mind. So tell us a little bit about that, because I thought that was
poor Louis Del Grandi, who played that therapist. I mean, wonderful actor.
Yeah.
And his wife was a wonderful actress. From then on, he was known as a guy whose head blew up in Scanners. You know,
now that's probably the iconic moments, right?
You know, it was also I also remember sitting down and pulling on my shirt. It was funny when I saw it the other night. As soon as I saw him walking down and sitting down, and he gets in the chair and crosses like. And adjusting my shirt cuffs, I was like, "Oh my God, I remember that! I remember the feel of the fabric."
Oh wow!
That was an interesting thing. We were kind of making it up as we went along, some of the special effects and shit, you know. Stefan Dupuis was the special effects guy. He made that Louis Del Grandi head and stuff. And I think it was full of chicken livers and dog food was what the brains were. At least that's what he told me. And it was a shotgun on a. Put a 45-degree angle behind the chair at the base of the skull. And they said, we want you – you're going to be sitting here and there, and I'm watching them hook the shotgun up beside me. And I'm seeing half-inch and quarter-inch plexiglass going all around the cameras, and I'm going, and I'm working class East End of Toronto, and they said, what's the problem? I said, I want $1 million for sitting here. They said, what? I said, I want a guarantee of $1 million if anything happens to me. And they all got crazy and went together and said, well, maybe we can shoot it without him being in it, you know, and stuff like that. And so I went and stepped off. This is my first act of defiance in Canadian film. We stepped off, and when they shot the shotgun off, it hit the plexiglass and bounced back and actually shredded part of the chair where I was sitting. I would definitely have been hit.
Yeah.
Wow. It was three or four pellets went in at the top of it, and some bounced off the but what a scene.
Yeah, it's incredible. And the sound is the other thing that holds that together, where you're just in that world.
You know, and it was – and where does an actor get an entrance like that
into
a film or into a – you know, it's
– And those facial expressions you're pulling are just like – it's vicious stuff.
No, we don't have time to go into it. But
we have time. We have all the time we need. I mean, you mentioned Visiting Hours, and that's one I discovered later, but it's a vicious character. He's like a very sadistic. He's to me, one of those characters that really
transcends
the movie.
He's a damaged character.
Yeah.
He's a very, very damaged character. That's another wonderful script that probably needed more time and more money to be done properly with Lee Grant, Linda Pearl, and stuff like that. And Bill Shatner.
But see, I was going to ask, like, how do you get into a character like dark and sadistic? But you've already answered. You've already seen the empathy in it.
I was sexually abused as a kid up until I was about 9 years old and stuff. And I used a lot of that.
Interesting.
And using that kind of anger. Because most, you know, we're all born – you want to get really fucking bored here. I'll tell you about it. I think we're all born out of love. Fear is an attempt to get back to love, you know. And all the faces of fear, anger, and all that stuff is a way of trying to get back. And that's what I was basing that character on, you know, is that constant. If you can't get back to a state of love, you're going to blame. You're going to look for people who cause it. There's a great scene in Visitors. I think Jean-Claude Loiter directed, knew we were in trouble, when he said one of the first scenes we shot was Lee Grant's attack at her house.
Yeah.
And I said, it's got to be special. It has to have some kind of androgynous sexual overtone to it. And he says, I don't understand what you're – and I said, no, it's because they originally had me just sort of hiding behind a shower curtain or something. And I said, give me 5 minutes. And the set was set up, and I went in there, and I literally took all my clothes off. And there was all this fake jewelry there and stuff, and I started putting it all over my face and like that, and took makeup, rubbed it on my eyes, and I said, come on in, and I hid behind the clothing, and they said, where are you? And I stepped out, and everyone went, like that. And I said, and they said, he went, yeah. That's all we got to do this. And it was based on the idea of sexual mockery, I don't want to bore you with it, but there is an organic truth to the character in Visiting Hours. That's why that makes that film so scary.
And memorable. I think a lot of us noticed it. Otherwise, it could have just been another B-movie that passed you by.
And that impotence during the sex scene when he has the prostitute with him mm-hmm. and stuff, where he can't even look her in the face and yeah. stuff. I'll tell you a great joke. I'd never had a trailer before when I did Visiting Hours. Even on Scanners, it was like I got paid scale. And on Visiting Hours, I got a trailer. And I was practicing going in and out of my trailer. You know, I put the stairs down. I put the stairs. I would get in and out of my Winnebago, and they called me to set. And I just put the stairs up, and I stepped out and missed the stairs and broke my right ankle.
Oh no!
Or my left ankle. And in the film, when he's killing her in that scene, he's going after her before he's trying to kill her in the radiology, and he's limping. That's a real limp because I didn't take my boot off for 3 weeks. I had to make all the clothes. I said, if you take this boot off, I'm getting a cast. So we got to do this character for real, you know. And one of the only critiques I remember getting on the film was he was pretty good, except that limp is so fucking, you know, over the top. It's absolutely real, you know.
Do you carry, like, I'm always curious, like, I'm not an actor. Is it cathartic to be able to channel that into that role and then leave it behind? Or does the role stay, do some of these darker roles stay with you? You've played so many bad guys, obviously.
Damaged people, yeah. I'll tell you when something that's interesting. I'll use set things to build a character from my past, things like some of the sexual abuse I went through as a kid and some of the violence that I was witness to and stuff. And I remember being on a film. I think I told you this, Mike. I was on a film, and I went to reach for one of them to play this iconic kind of character. I went for it, and it was already resolved, emotionally resolved, and I went, oh, my God, it's gone. It's not there anymore. I don't have any kind of – I had resolved it in some way. So I had to go to something different. I remember thinking – it's like therapy. Acting is like therapy when it's done really well, for me anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
But then you come to it when you – so that's your Canadian period initially, and then you came to America. And was V the first break in, like, taking you to mainstream audiences?
I came down to sell a script, which has still never been done. It's a great script. Excuse me. And Brian Taggart was doing the second miniseries for V.
Yeah.
And he got touched through friends or family in Canada and said, where's Michael? And they had been trying to get a hold of me but didn't know how to get a hold of me because they didn't know where I was for V. And I went in to see them. And the V character actually was in a wheelchair originally.
Yeah.
The character was. And I said, I can't play this character. I said, I'd love to, but I can't. And they said, what are you talking about? I said, my name's Ironside. I can't sit in a fucking wheelchair. Yeah, and they went, fun. Oh, my God, you're right. Oh, shit. So because of Raymond Burley, you know. And so they sent Brian Taggart and I off to Palm Springs to rewrite the script. And we had it resolved by the time we got to Palm Springs. And I said, well, why do we got to stay here and go back? He said, Michael, it's Hollywood. Let's stay 4 or 5 days and enjoy ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
And give them their money's worth, you know. And so that's how I got on V.
Huh. So, and like, how did your career work? Was in terms of like working with somebody like Paul Verhoeven, who's coming up? Was it because they noticed you in other work, or were you just, is it through agency? I'm always curious if it's like someone like Paul Verhoeven saw you in Scanners or saw you in V, and that's what led them.
I don't know how the industry works now. Mike could probably address that. It's because we are so.
I don't know.
But it's so broad. I mean, everyone knows everything. We have the internet to look at people's performances. A lot of casting's done where the director doesn't even meet the talent until the last session of the casting.
You know,
they do everything on tape and stuff. In those days, it was through casting directors.
Yeah.
And casting directors that felt safe. I once got told by a casting director, I'm bringing you in for this part, but it's already been cast, but I want the director to have another choice. I wanted him to feel safe about his choice. And casting directors trusted me because I loved auditioning. I really did. It was like my first time. As an actor, when I used to audition, it's like before you get any direction, it belongs to you. It's like an open field of snow. You know what I mean? You can do any fucking thing you want.
You're scanning them.
And make it real.
I know you're going in there scanning them. I can
and,
just see
Paul basically got introduced to me on RoboCop.
Yeah.
And I turned it down.
Huh.
And
which role?
Originally, it was for the robot, the actual cop, and they said, look, if we put the uniform on him, he's going to look like a Sherman tank. because I was so big. I'm like a 46 jacket. And they offered me the part of the alcoholic kind of drug addict killer. And
Kurtwood Smith.
Kurtwood's part, yeah. And I was doing Extreme Prejudice at the time. And literally when I went to see Paul for that interview, that lunch, I was shooting the fountain scene.
Oh, yeah.
Where that three-day death scene.
Yeah, the Wild Bunch kind of riff.
In Extreme Prejudice. Yeah. And there's stuff in that the censorship board wouldn't allow. That Madonna and the fountain. We shot that almost for 3 days, different section of it, because every time we shot, I had to get redressed and remake up to it. But I have two blood torpedoes on me so that when I get that final hit and I go back in the fountain, the blood shoots up and goes all over the Madonna behind me and stuff. And Walter wanted a huge, I think, Walter's a great guy, Walter Hill. He wanted to make a real kind of comment about Sam and stuff like that and about Sam's attitude towards American policy and religion and stuff. And they wouldn't allow it in the film. It never made it the film.
Oh, bummer.
But that's
so what many I was good people in that.
So that's what I was shooting when I go in to do the interview, and they offered me the Kurtwood's part. And I went, I don't know if I want to really kill anyone right now. You know, I don't want to go around snorting cocaine and cutting people's throats out. And then when I was finished Extreme Prejudice, Paul and them were about 2 weeks into the film, and I realized, Jesus, you know, I just turned down working with Paul Verhoeven.
I've
learned that after that. I've talked to Mike about it. Never take on jobs while you're working, because your focus is so consistent in one and focused in one area that you don't see yourself doing anything to what's right in front of you. And you can't make I can't make a rational judgment about things. Cause I actually wrote Paul a letter saying I'm so sorry.
Oh, that's how you
He actually got it. And I actually didn't. It was one of the few times a lot of roles that were coming my way stopped coming my way because they thought there was something wrong with me. They heard that something had happened and that they wanted me for the part, and I didn't get it and stuff like that. And everyone assumed it was a personality or a character flaw that had happened between me and the producers and director and stuff. I found out about this later. So Paul basically, when he hired me for Total Recall, completely wiped all that out.
Yeah.
You know.
And what a role there.
Yeah. That's sound mixing upstairs.
Yeah. they do post a few.
I did have one extreme.
There's a lot of rumbling. So.
Like Extreme Prejudice movie, we talk about quite a lot because I actually think it's a fantastic movie and it's really hard to actually find now, and everyone's good in it. Like everyone has a great role. But I read something about it and I can't find it, so I don't know if it's true, but that Andy Robinson, who's also another great genre vet, and that film was so stacked with great actors, had a bigger role in that you became the lead, basically.
He played Nick and Powers are the leads.
Yeah.
And Maria Conchita, but he was my partner. We were I'm CIA and he's the...
Which he doesn't appear at all in the cut.
And he didn't appear at all because Walter put the film together. He called me and he said, look, I don't know how to do this, but I'm going to tell you something. And I had made a mistake. Well, not a fucking mistake. I had chose to put the humanity part of my character with Andy Robinson, which nobody ever gets to see. I got to play the fake... person with Nick and all those guys because he's playing a duality, and I got the ambitious part of the personality with my men, right? Because it's supposed to be like a CIA operative gone domestic. So when they cut out Andy Robinson's, I think the whole soul and humanity of the character was taken out of the part. And Walter said to me, he says, we cut the film together and it looks like a Michael Ironside film supported by Nick Nolte and Powers Booth. It's just too much of your character. That arc is so wonderful. But we're going to completely remove this one side. And I remember feeling so bad for Andy because he wanted it so much. He wanted that because he wanted to break that whole cycle of the way he was identified.
From Dirty Harry.
Yeah, from Dirty Harry. He wanted – and I kill him in the film. I have this huge – there's this great scene where I talk to him and it's this brotherly love and turn around. And it's like it's almost like killing yourself. It's a form of suicide by killing your partner. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, very huge and powerful scene. I've got a copy of Walter gave me a copy of it somewhere.
Really?
But
we all perked up. We're like, yes, we'd like to see that actually.
Yeah. I don't think I'm allowed to.
I won't tell anyone.
As long as you're not making money off it, it's probably fine.
The problem is it's on 3/4.
I'm coming to Canada to watch
that. We're all friends.
I'm in Los Angeles.
Oh, you're like, okay.
Yeah.
What is it that makes Paul so effective? I mean, because last year's Paul's film, which was so, just so in your face, what's in it? L. I thought it was the best film of the year. It's just like amazing how he's always been able to – I feel like all his films have satire. Like there hasn't been one that doesn't seem like has that element. But what was it about working with him that you enjoy so much? Because obviously Starship Troopers is the ultimate satire. We were talking about it off air a bit, but.
Well, oh, Jesus. I want to get around to talking about Knuckleball because, yeah. You know, but, and I'll bring you in this, and I don't mean, this is Mike Peterson I'm talking yeah. to. I've done over 300 plus features, yeah. right? And I think I said this, maybe I said it the other night. I didn't. I work with only maybe five directors that are thought of as the, you know, the director, the guy. And that means somebody who their every wish is supported, where they're the author, they're the person, and Paul's one of them. They're the artist who controls everything. And I don't believe this is an auteur medium making films. I think it's a tribal medium. I think on any given day, there's not everyone has an answer. You know, Mike's wonderful to work with. He basically would take suggestions from everybody and anybody to improve a situation. He'd let it resonate against his own ideas, and if it helped, he would do it, and if it didn't, he'd explain why, and we'd move on. But Paul was one of those guys that you didn't do fuck all unless it was always his way of doing things. You know, he didn't change scripts. If you want to change or you want to discuss a change, it had to be a week before the scene came up. Hmm. Within that week, you didn't, you know. It's very funny. We were on Starship Troopers, and there's that scene when my character comes back and that hand comes into frame and camera, and he walks in. When we got there, him and Yos Fakanos, his DOP, they had run into a problem because we had overrun our sets. And it's the first introduction of my character back into the film from being the teacher, the one-armed teacher. And they hadn't finished the set. We only had one corner, and the camera was set up, and they were saying, I said, I got an idea. And I said, to Yos Fakanos, and he said, yeah, what is it, Mike? And I said, how about if you see the hand drop in front of the lens, you follow the uniform to the end of the barracks, he turns around, that'll introduce the character, and then he comes back. So all the dialogue's on his back. We never have to turn the camera around to see the other third wall on the set, and we'll be able to get our day that way, and we won't fall behind. And he said to Paul, that would work. Yeah. And Paul has everything etched in stone. And he went, let's try. They said, I said, you can do handle. You also said, don't tell me how to shoot it. You gave me the idea. And so that's what we did. And that night we were walking to the cars over at Fox, 20th Century Fox, and Paul stopped and he went, you gave me an idea today. And I got all frightened like a little boy. I did. Are we okay? He says, we've come a long way, haven't we? And that was kind of cool because, you know,
he's letting you in.
He had allowed somebody other than himself. He'd given up the reins of the stagecoach for a bit there. But no, I don't see this as an auteur medium anymore. Yeah. I really do see it's a collective. Monroe Chambers on Knuckleball. That was my idea, I think. I brought it up with you.
Yeah, you suggested that, and then I hadn't seen Turbo Kid yet, and I watched it, and there was something in his performance that was like the naivete and the innocence that I thought would make excellent underpinning for sort of the bad guy.
And my thing with Monroe Chambers is that he's a phenomenal actor, but he's never gotten the opportunity to show how broad his chart of colors is, you know. And I sent him the script, and he went, oh, I think we emailed him the script, and he went,
He was nervous.
He was like, I don't know about that. And I said, you want to be Gregory Dancer for the rest of your goddamn life, you know, with a little bit of hair bouncing in front of your eyes. And he said, and he talked to you, and I think that kind of resolved it. And when he came on board, Mike wanted to change slightly the way Monroe's character seemed. So they added a different hairline, slightly changed, just minuscule things, a little bit of prosthetics and a false set of teeth. And so that when he smiled, that wasn't your normal Monroe Chambers standing there, you know. And I think it's a phenomenal performance on his part. It really is, because I'm not easy to balance off. I'm not bragging, because I can stand there, and I'm being given it's a gift from the universe that I have a presence. And when we're doing that sequence, have you seen the film?
No, we won't see it till Friday.
Not till Friday.
Oh, son of a bitch. Yeah. Good. I won't tell you too much. There's some stuff. There's some stuff that happens.
Just tease it, you know?
No, there's some stuff in the film where, there's a duality. There's me, the character, the grandfather, Jacob, and then there's Monroe's character's version of me, how he perceives me. And there's that scene in the woods when he comes barreling after the kid and stuff. And we have that confrontation, and he very, very much holds his own. he has a sense of who he is, and his presence is it's quite large. I'm excited for him as he goes forward. He's about to start his first American feature in about a month, 2 months. I think January, first week of January.
I just know he's busy and he's great. We made another movie with him after that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You did a boat film with him.
Yeah.
Turbo Kid is part of the reason I was so excited to work for Epic Pictures. So I love that film. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's like a really fun movie.
Yeah, and your character in that is pretty terrific too.
Yeah, Turbo Kid was. It was sent to me, and I wasn't sure what their take was on it.
Yeah.
And I talked to the producer, and I called her the boss, and I called her Jeanette, and I said, "What do you want to do that?" She said, "I want to do it without any big cars, without any mechanism. I want to do this on the smallest scale, almost like satire. You know, I want to possibly put everyone on bicycles, and rather than getting frightened of being made a fool of, you know, because the script was so well written, I thought." All right, because you know, there's this part of you goes, "Oh, I don't want to do that. What if I don't look good?" Or, you know, you get frightened. And I've learned to sort of reverse that and say, "Okay, I'm in." Yeah, I'm kind of ironclad at this point. You're not going to damage my career. And it was fabulous. We shot that in a gravel pit just outside Montreal.
Wow, yeah.
That's all of Turbo Kid.
Yeah. And that's a movie on paper I can't imagine explaining to somebody. But then when you see it, you're like, "Oh." Oh, I get this.
It's so designed and visually oriented that, I mean, on paper, I'm not sure how that would read.
Yeah.
But the genesis of the characters in our film, you know, in Knuckleball and Turbo Kid are very similar. It's about isolation, separation. I came up with a word. I called it isolatory. I don't even know. And if it's used again, it's mine. I created it.
We'll take it.
But the characters really in Turbo Kid, here's a child that's got no parents, who's raised and stuff like that, who has a relationship with a mechanical human being, you know, who's, you know, and a doll who has an association and a relationship with that. And then we have a character in Knuckleball where everyone's separate, everyone's apart from, different and afraid, you know. And it's all about our inability to communicate with each other. That's the real horror.
Yeah.
You know, Knuckleball, I don't think you're going to get grossed out by any shotguns behind the heads or, you know, livers being popped at you and stuff like that. This is much more of a, I remember that feeling. I remember that situation. I remember that. I'll tell you something that probably Mike doesn't even know. I mentioned this morning because I've forgotten all about it. My daughter told me last night that when my character dies but doesn't die in the film, and when he finds the body, I got to get emotional here. That's the way my dad was found, in that posture.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. With his leg bent and laying on his back, looking to the left and stuff. Remember, I kept on saying, "Can we have it on this side? Can you bring the camera around on this side where the light's behind me and stuff?" And you said, "Yeah, why?" And I said, "No, I just feel more comfortable leaning this way because of my head." I didn't want to tell you. But when my dad passed about 10 years ago, my sister called me. And she said, "Dad's dying. He's had a heart attack. And I'm giving him permission to go." He lived in Northern Ontario. And she described to me, what, you know, because I couldn't be there. I was in another country. And she said, "He's laying on his back, his legs cocked, and he's breathing very shallow." And I looked like my dad in that scene. We left the beard the way it was and stuff like that. And seeing that on the screen was really cathartic. Mm. It was... Wow. And difficult because we had to watch my breathing because I didn't know we were going to shoot so much around my bloody my body. We have a whole chase scene that happens between the two other characters around my damn dead body. So I'm sitting there while these actors are chewing up the scenery, and I got to hold my breath
in your underwear,
and I'm in my underwear. Yeah, but rather cute underwear though, tight ones. Yeah.
Wow. Well, Michael, I was curious if you could tell us. I mean, we always ask everybody that comes on the show. We're VHS kids, we grew up on horror films. There were movies that just made us fall in love with movies, and it's the reason we're here now. What was that for you? What were the films when you were a kid that really had an impact that are the reason you're here now?
Geez, there's so many. It's pretty eclectic, and it's always a hard question to answer.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I could go from Time Bandits was one that I went and watched a ton.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one because all my dad would basically be like, you know, we can't decide on something. We're getting time bandits then. So that's we watch that.
You get everything with time bandits. It's every kind of movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's a lot of different movies. Yeah. So that was one that definitely played a big part.
Well, we were talking the other night, and when I come up with a film, there's a film that we may do together and stuff. And I was talking about, and I found when I come up with a film, you've seen it. Both of us, it's almost like we have this simpatico. I was talking about Parallax View.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I was saying Parallax View. I think about that, again, that idea of turning a story on a dime there. And you said, yeah, I haven't seen that in a while. And we mentioned a couple of others. And
3 Days of the Condor would be in that group.
Same group. We're talking about
a lot of paranoia. In those two films, yeah.
And misinformation.
We're living disinformation.
Now. Yeah. You know.
There was a video store that I used to volunteer at. And if I put videos away, they'd give me free videos.
Nice.
So I would just watch whatever I could find. Yeah. It was kind of the informal deal I made with the guy. The guy probably just wanted to get rid of me. Uh-huh. And I was hanging out, probably annoying him, you know, because I'm 12 or whatever. Yeah. So I was trying to remember some of the films that I watched. The other day I was talking to a friend that owns one of the last video stores, I think, in Canada. And Band of the Hand was one that I remembered.
Yeah.
Black Roses.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like there's just like all of these movies. Like I just drank them up.
Do you remember your first Ironside?
It would have been Scanners.
Yeah, Scanners.
For sure.
Not Hello, Mary Lou, Prom Night 2?
Nope.
That was later. You know that was originally not supposed to be a satire. That was written, as a complete... Paul Lynch, by the way.
It wasn't a sequel, right?
No. It was... Mary Lou, Prom Night 2 was actually... It was taking Carrie and making it darker, even darker.
Wow, because it's funny. I know. It's a total comedy.
And Paul Lynch wanted to do it, and I signed on. Paul's an old friend. And the company, if I remember right, changed hands in the middle of the post-production, and they decided to go in a different direction. They found a marketing hook decided to exploit the hook rather than the actual
film. It's a really funny, fun movie. Whether you started with that in mind, I think it's a little gem.
We went back and shot sequences to support their new way of looking at things and stuff like that. It was a lot of fun.
You as a principal.
Me as a principal. Yeah.
Is there anything, I mean, in a 40-year career, playing so many different types of characters?
Yeah, don't cut me short. 46 years.
I was trying to be, you know,
I'm 68 years old. I started when I was 20.
But is there something is there a kind of role you haven't played, and you're talking about those five directors that, you know, in your career, is there a person whose work that you still are so inspired by that you would love to work with? And you might not be able to say that on air. I don't know if that's a part of the actor's code. But is there something you haven't been able to express that you're still trying to, be interested in?
I really do. Like, somebody asked me this just recently. I said, look, the past is memory, which is always faulty. Because it's not organically correct. It's based on it's an abstraction. The future is a speculation based on memory. So it's an abstraction. And the only real thing we have is the moment now. Like we're here right now, sitting here with Mike. And I want the opportunity to keep working. I'm still growing. I'm still learning. I'm still trying to find things. I just went through three different bouts of cancer in the last 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And it's true. My wife had breast cancer twice, and. And we're different. I have a completely different agenda after coming through all this. And that's what I want to work on. You know, I want to work on – I remember I was playing cards in the 70s. I used to play poker and stuff in Toronto. And a friend called up and said, can you get a couple of grand again? And blah, blah, blah. And I said, what? He said, I got a card game at the Windsor Arms upstairs, and we need a sixth seat, you know. And I said, yeah, I went and borrowed a couple of grand. And I walked in, and when I turned around to sit down, John Huston was sitting at the table with his oxygen tank and stuff. And I went, oh, fuck, you know. And I was a nobody. I'd done visiting hours and Scanners, but we had no money. About an hour and a half into the game, I stuck him with a pair of jacks and nines and in stud poker, five stud. And he had two smaller pairs and stuff like that. But and mine was hidden, and I was so pleased with myself. I just stuck John Huston. And I think I made a great grand total of like about $3,700 on the hand, you know. And we had a stand-up bar behind it, and we called a break, and I was over having a drink. And he walked up and he says, "You feel pretty proud about yourself, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah, yeah." And I felt safe enough now that I'd done this that I could ask him a question. And I said, "Can I ask you a question?" And he said, "Of course." And I said, "Look, you've done absolutely some genius work. You know, you did all these amazing films, right up to Moby Dick. And there's some great stories you told me about Moby Dick and stuff." And I said, "And after Moby Dick, it's kind of like you just fell off the end of the world. You started doing crap and shit." Like, and I stopped and I looked at John Hughes and I realized I just told John Hughes that he made crap and shit. Wow. And he put his hand forward and put it on my shoulder and he says, "You're absolutely right." He says, "After Moby Dick, I was bankrupt emotionally, mentally, financially, and spiritually." He says, "And now I don't know when I'm going to go out. I don't know when my last film is, so I have to treat everything with a certain amount of dignity and a certain amount of focus because it might be my last song." And he had just done, he was doing the post-production on Brad Dourif's film.
Wise Blood. Which I think the Flannery O'Connor.
He had shot it and didn't have the money to do the post-production. Oh. And it had come up to pick up. The director on a Ryan O'Neill and Tatum O'Neill film in Toronto had been fired or had a nervous breakdown. And John's, I don't know if they know this, John's dead, so hell with him. He came up and muscled his way into it so he could get a paycheck so he could do the post-production on Wise Blood.
Wow.
And he said, "I just don't want to go out on a bad note." And I'm not comparing myself to John Huston. But after the cancer, I got that sense that I'm being very specific about what I choose to do. Very specific. And who I work with. And I'm not jerking you out. I mean, it's like, no, you never know when it's going to be the last song, you know? And I don't want to leave something behind. I did a film in Vancouver years ago with more money than God. And it was horrible. And I literally got suicidal on the film. Mm-hmm. I started calling family members and stuff and saying, "I don't know what the fuck I'm doing here. You know, I don't go near the balcony. I moved my room in the hotel down to the third floor because I don't want to jump. Mm-hmm. I feel absolutely ashamed and like I've prostituted myself. And I don't want that feeling." I couldn't stand that feeling. And I sat down with my wife and my daughter, at that time my older daughter, and I made the decision. I said, "I'm not going to do anything based on finances anymore. I'll do something to keep myself viable. And then we'll wander off and do whatever we want." And we've been able to travel all over the bloody world. You know, we've been everywhere doing these films from
Edmonton.
All the way to Edmonton. Yeah.
You know.
Well, I mean, that's great. You got to do the work that you care about. And so people will be able to see this movie on Friday. How will they see it?
It's on VOD. Got all the VOD services. And it's in Austin at a theater.
Oh, the Draft House?
I don't know which one off the top of my head. But if you look it up.
Well, here in Los Angeles, it's at
the Arena Cine Lounge.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Yeah.
So it's playing there.
We're
going to
do
Friday.
A Q&A afterwards.
Okay, cool.
Friday.
Oh, that's worth it. Yeah, for
and
sure.
Stuff like that.
And in North Carolina.
Okay.
You know?
We have listeners in North Carolina.
Awesome.
I think.
Well, cool. I went to UNC, so it was really important for me to play it at one of the places that, you know, felt like it was,
I've got to tell you, though, that I hope it gets a bigger and a wider release because it's one of those films that really should be seen in that. In that cave where the lights go down and the lights come up and stuff, because you and I both talked that when we were at the festivals and stuff, people stayed. Hmm. They were absolutely, you know, and it's not. It's about a young
Fantasia,
boy.
Fantasia was a blast.
It was fantastic. Hmm. It really was, and audiences were like, "Well, why did that really touch me? Why did that happen? Why did you do this? Or who came up with this idea?" They were absolutely engaged.
Yeah,
and it moved people. I have this thing, I don't know if I mentioned it earlier, where I call it a peach and a beer movie. You see it, and you go out and have a peach and a beer, and you forget about the film. This is not a peach and a beer film. Mm. This actually stays with you. Mm. I had, my daughter saw it, and she, but a week later, said, "Whose choice was that not to hug when you're in the driveway?" And I said, "That was all of our choices. We wanted no physical contact." When Kathleen comes up and stuff, that sense of constant tension between everybody.
Lack of connection.
Lack of connection.
Well, that's great. I can't wait to check it out. Yeah. Knuckleball out on VOD, DVD and select theaters right now as you listen to this. Thank you, Michael Ironside. Thank you to director Michael Peterson for coming by.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, we appreciate you spending the time. It's inspiring to hear from you, and your work has really meant a lot to us.
Well, thank you very much. I've still got more to learn, and I hope I get opportunities to try some of this stuff out. And
yeah, that's really cool.
Thanks, man.
Thanks so much for coming, guys.
God bless.
Yeah, cheers.
All right, see you soon.
Halloween is coming up, and that means it's time to listen to some creepy fiction horror podcasts.
No Sleep Podcast is the godfather of them all, with over 2 successful U.S. tours and 100 million downloads.
October is an extra special month for them, in which they release their seminal Halloween episodes. Listen to past Halloween episodes to get caught up, because it's a treat.
David Cummings from No Sleep is also an executive producer on Darkest Night.
And Darkest Night's a binaural audio drama that places you, the listener, at the center of a recovered memory that sounds as though it's happening around you in real time. Each chapter delves into the last memories of the recently deceased, slowly revealing a horrifying master plan. Who is weaving this master conspiracy, and what is their ultimate goal?
Darkest Night is a binary recorded horror podcast, so when you listen in headphones, it is like a 360-degree experience. They even have a full score and real string section on there by Alex Aldia and Andrew Jocelyn, who works with musicians such as Odessa, Macklemore, and Mark Lanigan.
Darkest Night Season 3 is narrated by legendary Keith David, The Thing, Requiem for Dream, Armageddon, and so many more, as well as features acting appearances from RuPaul, Paul Scheer, Constance Zimmer, Dennis O'Hare, Missy Pyle, Michelle Visage, Jason Mewes, Jay and Silent Bob, you should know that, David Cummings, Dan Harmon, and many, many more.
And we actually have a special treat for you Shockwave listeners and are going to debut the first episode from Season 3 right now. Put on your headphones if you got them and enjoy this special advanced listen to No Sleep.
It's binaural.
And you promise we'll get to see Ernie, right? I'll get to meet him?
Yes, sweetie, you'll get to meet Ernie the elephant.
But you said that the last time we went to Safari Valley. And then Dad got that call and...
No calls today, buddy. I promise.
Look, the gates are opening!
Welcome to Safari Valley, where every day is an adventure.
Hurry, let's get in line.
Matt was only 7, but his adorable yet persuasive charm had twice gotten him into Safari Valley, a local theme park his parents hated. Matt knew it and felt guilty for dragging them there, but he needed to meet Ernie. The toothy-smiled elephant was his favorite character on Safari Friends.
Look, there he is. Come on.
The little family hurried toward the end of the promenade, where a line had started to form around the park's most popular mascot. By the time they reached the end of it, the line had grown all the way back to the park's entrance.
Did you know that elephants are the largest land animals in the world?
Baby, this line is really long.
At least 40 minutes.
Why don't we do some rides first and meet Ernie after lunch?
Mom, I want to meet Ernie now!
Did you know that an elephant's skin is over an inch thick?
Your mom's right, buddy. Rides first. Hey, how about the Tilt-A-Whirl?
But you said...
Emily bent down to Matt's level and addressed her son.
I promise you, you will not leave this park until you've met Ernie the elephant. Do you believe me?
Yeah, I guess.
Did you know that elephants can live to be over 70 years old?
Matt, you're tall enough to do the cheetah chase this year.
I am?
The day passed quickly, and morning turned to midday, which turned to afternoon. Matt pointed out Ernie every time he saw him, but his parents were reluctant since the line never slowed down. Each Ernie that went unmet only frustrated Matt more.
Look, there's Rambo the Rhino. You want to meet him?
No, Dad. Rambo's lame. I want to meet Ernie.
Did you know that a group of rhinos is called a crash?
It has to be Ernie, huh?
Let's just get in line for the next Ernie we see. He's not going to be happy until he meets that damn elephant.
Don't say mean things about Ernie, Mom.
You're right. I'm sorry.
Did you know that rhinos can run up to 40 miles an hour?
The tired family continued around the park, re-riding rides and searching out Ernie the elephant. Matt's parents were weary, sunburned, and looking for an out.
See Ernie anywhere, sweetie. How about Jenny the giraffe?
Did you know giraffes sleep standing up?
No, I don't want to meet Jenny or Gordy or Winnie or Rambo. I want to meet Ernie. Please, Mom, you promised.
I did.
Em, it's 30 minutes to close. Look, I know you promised, but you can't work miracles, and I haven't seen an Ernie in over an hour.
What do you mean, an Ernie? There's just one Ernie, Dad.
You're right. I'm sorry, buddy. I'm just tired.
We promised him he'd see Ernie, Don. That's the only reason he cared about coming here. I'll ask one of the park staff.
Why don't we just slowly make our way towards the entrance and get in line when we see him?
But what if we don't see him? Would we just leave before I met him? Please, Dad.
We can't leave like this.
It's been a long fucking day.
Don't swear in front of Maddie.
Oh, yeah, like you're a bastion of purity around the kid.
Okay, don't you dare start with me.
Matt blinked the tears from his eyes and turned away. It wasn't the first time his parents had fought in public, and he was embarrassed. All he'd asked for was to meet Ernie the Elephant. And now, it looked like that would never be. Matt whipped his head up. Was that? Yes, that was a trumpeting elephant. Ernie was nearby. Matt jumped up and down, trying to see over the heads of the crowd. Where did it come from? Where was Ernie? If only he could get close enough. There, in between the buildings of the Midway Games, Matt could see Ernie walking. His green lounge coat was flapping behind him, and his tail was twitching. Ernie was getting farther away. Matt looked back at his parents. They grew louder and more animated in their argument.
We gotta figure this out or he's gonna throw another tantrum.
We can't change time.
Did you know elephants never forget? They remember every insult and rejection.
Matt took one last look at his parents, then bolted through the crowd after Ernie. He wouldn't miss him this time. He wouldn't. As Matt grew closer to the strip of Midway Games, he caught sight of Ernie between the buildings. Tripping over a tired father of two, Matt bolted through the alleyway, leaving the arcade and guests behind him.
Ernie? Ernie!
The park's PA system chimed in above.
Did you know elephants are born blind? Play a fun game with Ernie by finding him before he finds you.
Ernie?
Matt emerged from the alley to the quieter area behind the buildings. He looked left and right, searching for Ernie, among the generators and long cords stripping the pavement in front of him.
Ernie!
He watched as one of the long shadows began to move. It was Ernie! He was walking away from Matt.
Wait! Wait for me!
Matt ran to catch up with Ernie, dodging cords and littered soda cans.
Did you know elephants can run at speeds of up to 40 miles an hour? Better keep up.
Matt thought about crying over his fall, but there was no one around to hear him, except for Ernie. And Ernie was almost to a small brown building nearby already. The elephant was headed for the door.
No! Wait!
Ernie opened the door and disappeared inside. Matt stopped in front of it, contemplating. He knew he shouldn't follow Ernie, though that didn't stop him.
Did you know elephants make friends for life? Once you befriend an elephant, you'll have a pal forever.
Matt looked down a set of service steps, lit by orange utilitarian wall sconces.
Hey, are you down there?
Matt descended the stairs quickly, hoping to catch Ernie. At the bottom, he saw a long, wide hallway that split off in two directions at the end. The underground area was filled with long, singing pipes and copper engines powering the park's rides above his head.
Ernie, where are you?
Ernie's trumpet came from the end of the hallway, though from which direction was impossible to tell. Matt ran as fast as he could, stopping at the fork, calling down both.
Ernie, can I just have a hug?
He studied the corridor the sound came from. It was darker than the other one, but the hum of machinery was louder.
Did you know elephants give the best hugs? Ernie has more than 40,000 muscles in his trunk to squeeze you with.
I'm coming, Ernie!
Matt ran after Ernie. Every time he came to a fork in the passageway, he would call to his favorite friend, and Ernie would answer. Matt followed until he was hopelessly lost. But that was okay. Ernie would show him the way out. He came to yet another intersection, and before he could even call, Ernie bellowed nearby. Matt spun toward the sound and turned the corner, only to find a dead end. The humming lights on the wall popped and sizzled. One went out, then two, until only three bulbs were left to light the now darkened hallway.
Ernie.
At his name, the elephant stepped out of the shadows. He stood underneath one of the remaining bulbs and froze.
I just wanted an autograph. My mom has my book. Can I... Oh, do you want a piece of candy? I have some Skittles in my pocket we could share.
Ernie opened his mouth until his jaw gaped open, and Matt saw into the black nothingness behind his small, square teeth. There was nothing behind them but a dense, consuming void.
Did you know elephants have large appetites and can consume up to 600 pounds of food?
Matt stepped forward and stood on his tippy toes and poured half the bag of Skittles down Ernie's throat, careful not to reach past his teeth.
How much do you weigh?
Matt stumbled back and looked up at the ceiling, searching for the speaker. He was starting to feel scared.
Are you talking to me?
Ernie hadn't moved. He stood still against the wall with his mouth open. Matt was afraid. This Ernie was different, not like his friend on TV. He suddenly wanted very much to find his mom and dad.
Okay. Bye.
Matt turned away, leaving Ernie standing there motionless, still gaping. As he turned the corner, Matt heard the pop of the bulb going out above Ernie. The sudden darkness pushed him forward like a wave in the ocean. Matt didn't remember his way to the stairs, but he ran anyway. Occasionally, he heard the pop and fizzle of the bulbs going out behind him. But still he ran, the labyrinth of corridors becoming more intricate and confusing as he went. He turned a corner and stopped short. Ernie stood against the wall at the very end of the hallway. He was facing Matt. A light bulb popped behind him.
Go away, Ernie. I want to go home.
Matt backed up and ran back down the dark corridor. There was little light, and long shadows moved alongside the chugging machinery.
Did you know elephants have excellent hearing? They can hear the quietest footstep from up to 3 miles away.
Go away!
Matt could hear Ernie's footsteps behind him. His heart was pounding. He was afraid to turn around to see, but he just couldn't help himself from looking back. Matt could see him in between the shadows. Ernie was following behind him with large, confident, unhurried, yet thunderous strides.
Leave me alone!
Did you know elephants kill over 500 people per year? That's more than sharks and spiders combined.
Stop talking to me!
I'm not talking to you. I am just a recording.
Matt ran, Ernie followed. It grew so dark, Matt could not tell the moving parts from the limbs of the elephant.
Stop following me!
Matt was frozen in fear. He felt around in the dark hallway, scooting up against the wall, squeezing himself in between two concrete pillars. The corridor was pitch black, and he knew he was well hidden. Soon, Ernie would walk right by, missing him. He would stay right here. His parents would surely find him, or an employee would come by soon. The park should be closed by now, and they were probably already looking for him.
Did you know that while elephants are colorblind, they can see in the dark? Did you know Ernie is right in front of you? He's there in the dark. He's waiting.
Matt buried his head in his hoodie. No, no, no. It was lying. The voice was lying.
Just reach out your arm, and you can touch him.
Don't talk to me. Go away.
Suddenly, a hand grabbed Matt's ankle, and he was hauled out of his hiding place.
Let me go! Let me go!
Matt's body was jerked around a corner and into a room filled with dim light. A single wall sconce covered them in an orange hue. Ernie whipped Matt around until he could stare into the vacant glass eyes of the elephant costume.
Oh, tell my mom!
Ernie let go, and Matt scrambled to his feet. The elephant stood silent and still, blocking the door, the only exit from the room.
Go away! Get out!
Ernie continued to stand, still as a statue, unflinching.
I know what you are. You're just a guy in a suit. You're trying to scare me. I hate you.
Nothing Matt said moved the elephant. Ernie continued to stand, arms at his side, head staring straight forward.
I hate you, I hate you, I hate you.
Anger overriding his fear, Matt ran up and knocked the head off the Ernie costume. There was nothing there. Where the wearer's head should be was only empty space. Matt stumbled back and fell against the wall. He couldn't take his eyes off it. Ernie hadn't moved. Only now, he didn't have a head.
What are you?
Did you know elephants are very intelligent and sometimes kill for pleasure?
Suddenly, the headless Ernie costume fell into a pile of empty cloth on the threshold. Whatever had been wearing it was gone. Matt choked back his tears and launched himself out of the room. He ran in the darkness, arms out in front of him. Matt must have turned a corner because a soft light started to tickle to the periphery of his vision. He turned toward it. Yes, there it was, at the end of the silent hallway, muted light spilling down from the ceiling. A staircase. He ran toward it.
Did you know it isn't going to let you go? You'll never come up the stairs. You'll be underneath this park forever.
Leave me alone. You're lying. You're a liar!
Matt was halfway to the bottom of the staircase. His lungs hurt, and his ankle throbbed where the thing had grabbed him. It was utterly silent, except the sound of his sneakers slapping the linoleum. A few more steps, and he was almost there. Matt was plunged into sudden darkness, yet again.
Let me go. I won't tell anybody. Please. Please.
He felt his way forward blindly. Matt thought the only way to reach the stairs was just to keep going.
Matthew! Matthew!
At the sound of his mother's voice, Matt stopped. It was coming from his left, from somewhere very far away.
Where are you, sweetheart?
Mom?
Matthew!
Matt turned and ran toward his mother, arms in front of him. Matt knew that if his mother was there, everything was going to be okay.
Matthew! Where are you? We can't find you!
Mommy! Daddy! I'm coming!
Matt ran and ran as he followed his parents' voices down the hallways. As he began to see the light of the exit, he noticed something in the distance. Something not quite so dark.
Matthew! How did you get down here?
Don't worry about it, Mom! I'm coming!
Underneath the last light bulb in the hallway, a shadowed figure stood underneath it.
Mom! I see you!
The closer Matt got, the safer he felt. It was his mother. He recognized the blue jacket and red hair. She opened her arms to receive him, and Matt flew into them. He was finally safe.
I was so scared. There's something down here with us.
He felt a hand on his shoulder.
We were scared too, kiddo. You're gonna be okay now. We need to get back upstairs. We're not supposed to be down here.
Dad? It's coming.
Is that Ernie?
Oh, look, there's an Ernie. Oh, maybe he'll talk to us.
Matt turned around to see what his father was pointing at. It was Ernie, of course. But there was something different about the costume this time. The face. The mouth. Was smiling.
No! We have to go!
Ernie pulled out an elephant tusk from his costume.
Holy shit! Dylan, get Matt out of here!
And stabbed Emily in the throat.
Oh my god! Emily! Emily! Run, Maddie. I won't let him touch you.
Dad!
Matthew, no matter what happens, I will always love you.
Oh, Dad, no!
Ernie! Whatever you are, stay away from my son!
Dad!
Ernie stopped in its tracks. He dropped the bloody tusk and slowly sauntered up to Dylan. After a moment of pause, it smiled.
Stay quiet. If we don't move, maybe he'll leave.
Ernie opened his mouth and decapitated Dylan with one clean swoop.
Oh my god!
As he watched his father's detached head fall to the floor, Matt stood there in shock. Ernie slowly approached him, and Matt turned to run. As he tried to escape, he tripped over his mother's lifeless corpse.
Ow!
Never leave your enemy or their kin alive.
Ernie lifted his right foot. Stomped down on Matthew's helpless body.
Thank you for visiting Safari Valley. Have a great day.
Darkest Night is available on iTunes as well as wherever podcasts are found. Episode 2 of Season 3 is even available right now on the Darkest Night feed if you want to check it out.
Darkest Night also has ad-free episodes in lossless sound quality available a week in advance and on Shudder. So Episode 3 of Season 3 is available there right now, ad-free. Shudder is the top RSVOD service that has many of your favorite horror titles, including the original Halloween, Revenge, Channel Zero, and a ton more. You can get a free month of Shudder by using the offer code DARKEST at checkout.
So listen to the No Sleep Podcast and Darkest Night. And again, if you want to check out Darkest Night a week early and ad-free, go to Shudder.com and use the code DARKEST and get a free month.